TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Monday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Got a great show for you this afternoon. Coming up here in about 20 minutes or so, Selena Zito of the Great Revolt fame joins us. Her latest column, this House race could be a bellwether for the midterms rapidly approaching. I know it's the heat of summer, and it seems like the cold days of early November are a long way away, but they're getting closer. And now, again, is the time to get involved and engage. David Campbell of Effingham County, Illinois, talking about the engagement of gun owners across that state. Now, a growing number of, quote-unquote, gun sanctuary counties in the state of Illinois. And now the gun control activists are getting concerned. I saw a map. This is as of Saturday. And I counted, my math, I think I'm right on this, 32 counties, those counties in green, that have approved the a version, anyway, of the Second Amendment Sanctuary County Resolution. And then those counties in yellow will be voting soon. The counties in orange have a planned vote, or it's under discussion. And then those counties in red, you can see they're kind of sprinkled there throughout the map, but there aren't a whole lot of them. Those are the counties right now where there is no action planned on the Second Amendment Sanctuary Resolution. So we'll talk with David Campbell later on in the hour about what's going on there in Illinois. Also next hour, Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others talking about what's going on in Illinois, upstate in the Chicago area. Chicago's released a new report on firearms seized by police there. And Rob says when you actually go through the data, there's a lot that actually undercuts some of the arguments of gun control advocates. And if you're looking at ways to honestly reduce violent crime, as opposed to looking at ways to pass gun control laws, if you're looking at ways to actually reduce violent crime, to improve the lives of residents in Chicago, particularly those who live in high crime neighborhoods, maybe you want to quit listening to the gun control advocates. Maybe you want to start looking at what works, including what works and what has worked in Chicago. John Fund from National Review next hour as well. Democrats, he says, are dumping moderates. This was a fascinating story over the weekend. The California Democrats holding their state convention and declining to endorse the sitting U.S. Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, who won her primary handily. Well, it's not a Because, it's, you know, again, it's that winner-take-all primary. Everybody throws their hat in the ring. Republicans and Democrats, top two, go on to the general election. This being California, with two Democrats. So it's Dianne Feinstein, who I think had like 44% of the vote, and Kevin DeLeon, state senator. Remember Kevin DeLeon? Gun owners certainly in California know Kevin DeLeon well, as they know Dianne Feinstein well. Neither one a friend of gun owners or a supporter of the Second Amendment. But Kevin DeLeon, he's early 50s, so he's considered a spring chicken by Democratic Party standards. And he is the voice of the progressives, at least in this U.S. Senate race there in California. And so California Democrats declining to endorse the sitting Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein and instead endorsing Kevin DeLeon over the weekend. This is, Cameron, did you, I mean, when you saw that, of all of the crazy political stories that we've seen over the past couple of days, like, yeah, it's easy for this one to get lost, but just in terms of, like, how politics works,
yeah,
this was huge.
It is huge, and I guess Trump-Putin summit today is, of course, the big story, so it's, there's little time for stories like this, but it really is huge, and in light of Ocasio-Cortez's ascension and this, and we've been warning about it, and we're seeing every day the hard left of the Democrat Party, which will not serve them well in November.
I think undisputably it's not going to serve them well nationally in November. Here's the thing, though. I mean, is anybody, you know, so if Kevin DeLeon doesn't win,
and I don't think he is, but if he doesn't win, is that a rebuke to the activist wing of the Democratic Party, to the Democratic Party base, to the progressive base? I don't know that they'll even see it like that. I think it'll just cause them to redouble their efforts. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think, is very likely going to win that seat. I suppose, you know, Joe Crowley is still on the ballot as a the candidate of the Working Parties, Working Families Party. So it's possible that Joe Crowley could win, but he said, I'm not running. I've endorsed Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's just that, you know, in order for me to get off of the ballot at this point, I have to run for another office, and there's no other office that I really want to run for. So, I mean, it's theoretically possible that people could show up on Election Day and vote for Joe Crowley, and she loses. I don't think that's going to happen. So, you know, in these deep blue districts or in these deep blue states like California, when you make a mistake, and I think, that, again, this is just sort of a political mistake, but when you do that, when you say, oh, you know what, Dianne Feinstein is too moderate for us, we're going to cast her aside. She was great back in the 80s, but we've moved on since then. Mr. and Mrs. America, turn them all in? Really? Really? Like it's a request? Turn them all in? No. No, that's not how we roll these days. When they embrace that, it probably has less of an effect on them, even if they lose in states like California, than it does, regardless of whether they win or lose, in, let's say, Missouri or Montana or Indiana or North Dakota or Ohio or Western Pennsylvania. You know, places where they need to be able to win seats if they want to have a national voice. But places where, you know, we want to ban your guns, but we can't tell you honestly that we want to ban your guns. We embrace quote unquote democratic socialism, but we can't really tell you what's so democratic about it other than, well, we vote for it. Places where, again, Dianne Feinstein is too moderate to be a candidate. I just don't think those are messages that are going to really resonate in broad swaths of the electorate. But we'll talk about it with Selena Zito coming up later on in the hour, as well as John Fund from National Review next hour. In hour three, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joins us for this week's Liberty Update. Also, John Cardillo from the Rebel and Newsmax TV on attacks on cops nationwide. There were three separate attacks on law enforcement officers over the weekend getting noticed today. One in Massachusetts that we'll be talking about, one in Kansas City, and then the attack, police shooting in Chicago, where an individual who apparently was armed, had a FOID card, but not a concealed carry permit, from what I understand. And this was caught on tape. This was, you know, this was one of those things where, that I wasn't on social media at all this weekend. I was down in Bristol, Tennessee. I'll talk about that coming up a little bit later. But this was one of those stories I'm playing catch up with as I get online last night and this morning. And it sounds like Saturday night came, and I don't know if you were online for this, but it sounds like, you know, once again, we saw a lot of unrest based on some initial reporting that turned out not to be accurate.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I wasn't around that much on social media this weekend, and I tried to catch up to it, and I'm still trying to catch up on it because there is the body cam video. And it's interesting, and I'm glad you're going to talk to these guys today about this, because, you know, for so long now, activists have said, we need body cams. So they had the body cam, they showed the body cam video, and now the activists are, oh, they could have edited the body cam video. when is it enough? I really doubt the Chicago Police Department went and edited the body cam video. I would imagine they didn't. But it just doesn't seem, no matter what the narrative is, you've been push forward the narrative, even when you had the video right there. And at the same time, you know, we see every week on this show and other places, we see the carnage in Chicago, and there's not even close to one of these reactions. Some of these videos yesterday for these protesters against the cops were really nasty stuff. And I certainly don't wish violence or protest on anybody or any city. But what will get people as mad on what goes on in Chicago on a daily basis? The 99.9% of the crimes that affect the people who live there. When is that riot worthy? When is that pissed off worthy? You go to the Dan Ryan Expressway all day, but why aren't you in front of gang members' houses or in front of jails or in front of prisons when they're being let out or let out on bail. That's the kind of stuff I don't understand. If you want to riot and be pissed off about something, fine, but there's no logical consistency going on in Chicago.
No, and I think, I think nationwide, I mean, that's something that is a sort of a common theme here on this program. We talk about our deal of the day, right? If you want to talk about reducing violent crime, let's not even talk about reducing violent crime. If you want to make your neighborhood safer, if you don't want to see gang members controlling your city block, if you want your kids to be able to go outside and play, how do you get there? I mean, that's ultimately the basic question. Do you get there by marching and shutting down the Dan Ryan Expressway? Do you get there by, going out and protesting or rioting based on unsubstantiated reports that you may have seen on your social media? Do you get there by going out and protesting when the gang member who was out on bond for a violent crime commits another violent crime, allegedly, and then is able to bond out again? Do you make your neighborhood safer when you stand outside of the Cook County Jail and you protest that guy coming out? You probably don't make your life any safer. But what is the most effective thing that we can do? I mean, again, that's at the heart of this discussion. What works? What doesn't violate our constitutional rights? What allows us our individual liberty and freedom, as well as combating the violent crime caused by a small number of individuals in our society? And, you know, frankly, it really doesn't seem to be part of the discussion much in Chicago. Cameron's right about that. It all seems to be used towards some sort of greater political end to advance the cause of a career of a politician, or to get in front of the camera. But it doesn't really seem to be about making it safe for kids to play outside, for ensuring that there are consequences for engaging in a drive-by shooting or shooting at a playground, or heck, even before it gets to that point, to ensure that there are consequences for that armed robbery, that carjacking, and the violent crimes that lead up to these human tragedies. Anyway, we'll talk about it coming up with John Cardillo in Hour 3. We also have our Hero of the Day. We have our Deal of the Day. We have our Good Guy as well coming up at the top of Hour 3. And then, of course, throughout the afternoon, we have all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information, including news out of Illinois this afternoon where Governor Bruce Rauner has signed two gun control bills, according to the State Capitol Bureau of the Statesman Journal, the so-called red flag bill, and a bill that requires a 72-hour waiting period for the purchase of all firearms in the state of Illinois. The 72-hour waiting period had previously applied for handgun sales only. Rauner also said that he will veto a bill that requires gun dealers to have a state firearms license because he says it imposes a hardship on small business. That bill has not yet been sent to the governor. This red flag bill, according to local news accounts, House Bill 2354, allows either an immediate family member or law enforcement officials to go to court if they fear a person with access to guns is, quote, likely to do something violent. If the court determines the person poses a threat to himself or others, it can order that the person's guns be removed by law enforcement. Because the actual language of the bill here, one of the concerns, obviously, that you have with these bills is that there are due process protections so that it's not let's declare you unfit first and then we'll actually figure out if that's true or not later. We'll look at the specific language of this bill over the next little bit. Also, more news to at least mention quickly before we have to take a time out of Ohio, where you will recall the city of Columbus had passed a host of gun control ordinances. They said that they could, despite the fact that Ohio has firearms preemption law, and the state legislature has said, we're the body that will set a uniform firearms policy for the state of Ohio. City of Columbus said, no, we think we can do these things, and we don't think there's anything you can do about it. Well, there was a lawsuit And Buckeye Firearms Association, Ohioans for Concealed Carry, filing suit challenging the bump stock ban passed in Columbus. And Franklin County Judge David Kane ruled on Friday that, no, the state firearms preemption law is what it is, and Columbus can't pass their local gun control laws. The judge upheld the law that allows Columbus to charge some people convicted of violent felonies with misdemeanors for being in possession of a firearm. Now, ponder that for a second. Because, again, if you want to talk about the futility of these gun control policies that Columbus was pushing, because they could, the politicians could say that, look, we did something. And, you know, we have to do something. This is a do-something policy that does nothing. It allows the city of Columbus to charge some people convicted of violent felonies with misdemeanors for being in possession of a firearm, for being a felon in possession of a firearm, which is a felony crime in Ohio. It is a federal felony crime in the U.S. Code. And in Columbus, it's now a misdemeanor. Tell me, what does that do exactly? Other than, again, allow a politician to claim with a straight face, I did something. You catch a guy with a gun. He's got a violent felony to his name already. What are you going to do if you want to send a message? You got to refer this case to the U.S. attorney? You got to charge him with a crime that could put him away for 10 years, having to serve 85% of that sentence before he's eligible for parole? You got to send it to state court? Possible 5-year sentence? Or you got to refer this to the municipal court, where he's got to face a misdemeanor charge and no more than a year in jail. So the judge said they can uphold that law. How many times do you think that law is ever going to be enforced? How many times is that law ever going to be used? And frankly, if a prosecutor ever uses that law instead of referring a case up to the U.S. attorney, asking the U.S. attorney's office to take it, or asking the county prosecutor to take it, they would decide, here's this violent felon we caught in illegal possession of a firearm. They would charge him with a misdemeanor. I sure hope the local paper reports on that. And I sure hope they ask those city council members, so why exactly did you want this law in the books anyway? And do you think it's appropriate that we prosecute this case at the municipal level rather than this guy going to serve time in a federal penitentiary? Is this what you wanted? Did you want to get tough or soft on violent criminals? But there you go. There's your do something law that's still on the books. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Selena Zito joins us, co-author of The Great Revolt. We've got David Campbell again coming up from Effingham County, Illinois, the later of the hour. So stick around. We'll be back with much more Cam and Company right after this.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say, I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA, with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and desert warfare, where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are. Well, everybody knows Bristol's a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium, and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. a lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children. And freedom's safest place.
Let me ask you a simple question. Do you believe you have a right to defend yourself and your family with a firearm in your own home? Four Supreme Court justices say you do, but four say you don't, because the deciding vote announced he's retiring. And your most fundamental right to self-defense could be extinguished. This is our opportunity to protect the one freedom that guarantees all the others. The freedom that makes America different from every other country on earth. The Second Amendment is at stake. America is at stake. We are the last place on earth that still believes in the fundamental God-given right of self-defense. And we don't care if we're the last ones in the arena. We will never, ever stop fighting for this freedom. We're the National Rifle Association of America. And we're freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host.
Glad to be with you today.
And glad we've got Selena Zito on the program with us, because I had a very Selena Zito-esque weekend driving down to Bristol, Tennessee and back. Selena, how are you today?
I'm swell. How are you? Did you buy new cowboy boots?
You know what? I will buy my cowboy boots. I bought my last pair there in Bristol, actually, on race weekend. So August 18th, I may have a brand new pair of boots. And because I've almost worn these out. But I got to tell you, it's so funny. I'm driving back Saturday afternoon, and I had wrapped up a little early. And I'm like, all right, I've given myself a little bit of time to do something fun. And do I want to go drive this road? It's called the Dragon's Backbone, I think. And it's this like twisty turny road in Virginia. I thought, okay, that's going to take too long. So I'm driving up 81. So I'm just going to get off the interstate, first of all, and I'll go from there. And that was my first Selena Zito-esque moment of just getting off the interstate. And I ended up in the tiny town of Floyd, Virginia. Have you ever been there?
I've been to Floyd.
Okay. And it's this little hippie enclave. There were, you know, deadheads in their late 60s and early 70s wandering around. And I should have right. And I should have felt very unwelcome there in my Bristol Night Race t-shirt, my Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race t-shirt. And now, you know what? It was great. Everybody was nice. Everybody was friendly to one another. I hung out there for about an hour and a half. Floyd Country Store, Republic of Floyd. It's a cool little town. And went on my merry way, drove back on the Blue Ridge Parkway a little bit. It was a wonderful Saturday afternoon, and I thought of you as I was there in Floyd.
Don't you feel better about the country when you do that? You're with people that you may not agree with politically, but nobody treated you as though you had a third head or a second head growing out of the side of your neck.
Right. Well, and so here's the other interesting thing, though. Even in Floyd, Virginia, a little hippiedom place where there are, you know, advertisements for the festivals held on the grounds of the farms. Everybody wants to be Maxie Asger. There are also signs where you can get your concealed carry license. And they're right. I mean, that's those worlds coexist. And you're right. In most of America, they tend to coexist very, not just peacefully, but comfortably with one another.
Very, very comfortably. It's absolutely amazing. I was driving around doing some interviews this morning, including with Steve Scalise, and I missed the president's speech today or press conference. On Russia. I still don't know exactly what happened. All I know is that I turned on the SiriusXM, turned on, I don't forget what news channel I had on, and all I heard was, this is unprecedented. This is the worst thing that has absolutely ever happened. And someone else said, yes, I've never seen anything like it. And I don't even know what happened. All I did was turn it off, because that could be any day of the week that ends with Y. Because that's always the reaction to absolutely everything that he does. I don't know what he did, but I do know that it made people feel that it made my profession have that reaction.
But as you say, it's Monday, right? And tomorrow it'll be something else, and then after that. And so, you know, so how do you think Americans are responding to that? I mean, I keep seeing these headlines, CNN's ratings. They're getting beat by, and I'm sorry, Cillian, I just realized that you're a CNN contributor, but when you're not on, HGTV's beating them. When you're on, leading the pack. But, you know, I mean, are Americans just tuning out generally?
And I hear that a lot from people. I mean, I don't have any hard numbers that say people have tuned out everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But people, when I talk to them, they're like, yeah, I can't do it. I have lost the will to listen every day, because every day, no matter what happens, if it's he has a hangnail, if he gave someone a hangnail, or if he did something incredibly egregious, all reactions are the same decibel. And that's almost like, you know, crying wolf, to the point where people are just like, I can't, I'm not anymore. I just can't do it anymore. And so that you and I have talked about this on the show. I have feared that was going to be part of the outcome if we continue doing that. And I even find myself just like, I just can't listen anymore. I can't remember the last time I watched television, because, you know, it's just everything. And I look on Twitter and go, girl's not doing that, because that's just crazy.
I've been doing Tweetless Sundays for about the past month, and I got to tell you, it's wonderful. You know, it lingers on into Monday mornings quite often. But
I did tweet about going to the rodeo this weekend.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah, it's going to be in my Sunday Examiner column. It was pretty amazing. But I will, a little sneak peek, I will tell you, when women talk about, in particular when women talk about, you know, girl power,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they have anything on what happens with women in rodeos. They're incredibly competitive with each other, but they're also incredibly supportive of each other. And just these, like, tight-knit group of women, you know, helping each other out and then, like, racing against each other. It was a really great sort of eye-opening experience that I want to take the readers into.
That is awesome. I cannot wait to read that. And in the meantime, we've got your column in the New York Post. This House race could be a bellwether for the midterms. Talk about a race in PA. What district is this in Pennsylvania?
Okay, so this is the new Pennsylvania 1st Congressional District. It's pitting Republican freshman Brian Fitzpatrick, a former FBI agent. His brother held the seat twice, held it 2004 through 2006, lost it in that midterm Democratic wave to Patrick Murphy, won it back 2 years later, and held it until 2016. And then Brian ran for the seat in 2016 and won it. It was the most expensive house race in the country in 2016. I suspect that we'll hold the same title again in 2018. It is a classic swing district. It's become a point more Democratic since the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court decided to become congressional line drawers. It's never happened before, but they meddled into the way that the districts are drawn in Pennsylvania. They redrew it. They made every seat more favorable to Democrats, including this one. He's facing challenger Scott Wallace. Wallace is the grandson of FDR's third vice president, and his grandfather, Henry, was sort of the mastermind of Social Security, and he made millions off of his seed company. I believe it was called Pendleton. And so Scott Wallace, while he was born in the district, hasn't been there for decades. He's lived in suburban Washington and South Africa. He's an incredibly wealthy man, and he's spent most of his time as either a Democratic donor or running the family foundation, which is sort of a social justice foundation. Bucks County, this is where the second Levittown is in this country. This is basically where the modern American suburb was constructed after World War II, where the sort of GIs came home to their sweethearts and they either used the GI Bill to go work in downtown Philadelphia or they walked on to a steel plant. And these are the sons and daughters of the sons and daughters of those people. And it's a really classic swing district.
And how is this shaping up this year?
Well, you know, Democrats are hoping that this is a bellwether. So are Republicans. Democrats are hoping it's a bellwether because they want to win this. But it may be one of those districts where a redrawn map and a ton of money don't make a hill of beans in winning, because in Levittown and throughout all of Bucks County, you pretty much have, it's a very locally centric district. I mean, local politics matters, and Brian Fitzpatrick has proven to be a very good local politician. He's got the backing of both the conservatives, but also the ACLU. He's really tuned into his district, where Wallace hasn't been here in decades.
Talking again with Selena Zito. All right, one more district I got to talk about, Selena. I tweeted this out to you. One of those, it's a great revolt district, New York 21. Win for Obama twice, win for Donald Trump in 2016. And this race is getting interesting because Tedra Cobb, who is the Democrat trying to unseat Elise Stefanik, who is the youngest member of Congress, got caught on tape telling a group of young gun control advocates that that she supports a quote-unquote assault weapons ban, but she can't say so publicly because she would lose the election. And not only did she tell some woman at a luncheon this, and she related that story to these kids, she then said that a member of Moms Demand Action had told her, you can't come out and talk about an assault weapons ban or you'll lose the election. And, Selena, this has been amazing to kind of watch this story play out and actually see it's been very disappointing, actually. I think the local paper up there really wants to endorse Tedra Cobb because they keep writing about not how Tedra Cobb violated the paper's no lies pledge, which she had signed just a few days before the story came out. They keep writing about how awful it is that Elise Stefanik hasn't signed this pledge. And isn't it horrible, Selena, that we've got, you know, this point in politics where we've got trackers and you've got people that are, you know, taping this stuff when candidates think they're off the record. Now, look, if you want to bemoan that, that's fine. But they're ignoring the fact that this candidate actually said, if I say I support a gun ban, I'm not going to win the election, which is interesting because Democrats are telling people, telling candidates nationally and trying to present this narrative that, oh, no, this is the year we can talk about gun control. Well, apparently not in New York 21.
It's kind of fascinating because, you know, on the one hand, you have the local paper complaining that the Republican hasn't signed it, but the Democrat that did sign it clearly violated it, and clearly lied. You know, you might not like trackers. I find them both annoying and wonderful, know, in terms of, look, you're not going to miss anything. It's just part of modern American politics, and that is not going to change until some other, you know, until they put a chip in our bodies. That's not going to change anytime soon. And look, not saying one thing and then doing the other is sort of how this conservative populist coalition was formed, because politicians do that all the time, and to just like fly in the face of not getting that sentiment and doing that and flat out lying about guns is sort of proof that she doesn't get this district at all and what their concerns are.
Yeah, we'll see how this plays out. It's going to be interesting, I guess. You know, there's probably not going to be a whole lot of polling on this district, but, you know, election day just a few months away. Selena, listen, thank you as always for coming on the program. Great talking with you today, and I look forward to reading that new column of yours coming up here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Always a pleasure. Selena Zito joining us here on Cam and Company. And who knows? Well, we may try to get Selena to do a report from the night race there in Bristol, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Coming up again, August 18th. NRARaceTix.com is where you can get your tickets. And I got to tell you, Karen, I found a new spot for us to eat, because every time I go down there, JT and the guys at the track, they always have a new barbecue. Well, new to me, but
right,
a different
right.
barbecue joint to place, right, or to try. So we've done Ridgewood Barbecue, which won like best barbecue in Tennessee. Absolutely amazing. This last time we tried Eats, which was in downtown Bristol, right off of State Street.
Yes.
Apparently this is where some of the drivers go
when
they're in town to get ribs. And they had ribs on the menu when we were there.
Was that the
best like, ribs I've ever had?
Was that the like car theme place? I kind of remember that on State Street. Kind of like an auto theme.
No, I don't think so. It's probably like
50s?
Half a block off of State.
Oh, okay. Then
Okay. And it's small. I mean, it's not quite a hole in the wall, but it's a small place.
Right.
There was one waiter.
Oh.
Best ribs I've ever had. Best collard greens I've ever had.
Man.
Oh, they were so good.
Oh, that sounds good.
It was amazing.
Mm.
So you're going to get to go down there, I think, a couple of days before I do for race day.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. You schedule a meal at Eats.
Pop's probably, he's already there right now.
Probably so. Well, I don't know. He just left Farmville, so it's about 4 hours from
turning
Farmville.
Around.
Right. I did give him some barbecue recommendations on the way out of town, though.
Good.
So hopefully he'll come back with some brisket for you guys. Yes. All right. When we come back after a quick timeout, David Campbell in Effingham County, Illinois, talking about the movement that is sweeping across the state there. The Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions, now more than 30 counties across Illinois have passed a resolution. And there are dozens more that are considering this in the very near future. We'll get an update from David right after a quick break, so stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way.
You've got a brand new book, our friend Frank Minniter helped put this book together with you, right?
That's right. He was instrumental. Couldn't have done it without him.
Conquer Anything, A Green Beret's Guide to Building Your A-Team. Now, I made a B.A. Baracus joke as we were going into the break, but you're really serious. I mean, talk about the concept of your A team, because I know that this is something that's really important to you.
Well, as you know, I spent my career in the Army Special Forces, and as a Green Beret, you learn the dynamics of great teamwork, and it has to get you through very serious environments, very serious execution plans. What I've found is that as tough as that is, and as much as you get tested through the course of military service and conflict in those environments, you can break that down and make it less of a military thing than it is a human thing. And we all share these characteristics. We can all have these team dynamics. The ways that it works are available to all of us. And so it was my goal to demystify some of the awesomeness in the movies and break it down where people can go to work in their own lives, in your home. Your A-team may have a dog on it. You know, your A-team's under your roof, or it can be a softball team on the weekend.
Right.
But building a team is only important when you want to succeed, right?
Absolutely. And again, those A-teams, they're wonderful to have around every day, but we all have those times of challenge, right? We all have those moments of crisis, and sometimes, you know, we're rugged individuals, we're self-reliant individuals, we like to think we don't need anybody's help, but that's not really what it's about. I mean, having that A-team, you're a part of somebody else's A-team.
I found out the hard way that I couldn't make it on my own. And as the medic on the A-team, I was always taking care of everybody else. But then when I was wounded so dramatically, it stopped everything in my life. And before you know it, I had people taking care of me in embarrassing and humiliating ways. I had never served anyone like that the way I was being served. And the things that I'd always taken for granted came clear to me, like service itself. And I used to think that a soldier toting a gun overseas was the ultimate image of service. But now I know better. My relationship with my Creator comes first in terms of service. Mm-hmm. But in a worldly perspective, Mama, she can be sick, tired, injured, hungry, and none of that matters. She's taking care of us through the night. But that kind of love and compassion is really what we're all about as a culture. I mean, even gun ownership, a lot of it has to do with having love and compassion for our condition and not allowing barbaric things to take it from us.
Absolutely. That's such a great way of putting it, too. And again, I know that there are going to be some folks who are watching this maybe who are just kind of curious about what happens at an interannual meeting. And they're going to hear, you know, this Green Beret talk about love and compassion. And this is probably going to... boggle some minds here, you know, but what you're saying is absolutely true. You know, again, the reason why we have so many great members of our military is because they love this nation. They love the freedoms that we have here. They love the people, and they want to protect the people. And as you say, owning a gun for self-defense, carrying a firearm for self-defense, it's not because we want to harm somebody else. It's because we don't want to see anybody harmed.
Right. As a warrior for a career, I'm sad that we have fought worldwide to maintain safety and security and freedom, but a lot of the threats and risks and violence has come to our towns.
Absolutely.
And our cities, and it scares the devil out of me, and I don't want that to be the case. And you're touching on something that's really important to me, and that's the notion that the military is great and very important, but it's not the most important thing. We wouldn't even have a military if the fabric of freedom in our country wasn't wonderful enough that it deserved to be protected. And people are willing still at this point to volunteer and go and fight and die for it. So for me, I think the focus needs to be more on Fort Living Room than Fort Bragg, because the fabric of our nation is at home at Fort Living Room, where Mama's the commander and love and compassion is the center of the universe.
Amen. Now,
which is really the only strength we have in the long run. Because you and me, we're sitting here feeling like we're cocky and strong in certain ways.
Yep.
We're good at certain things. But we were born slobbering on ourselves, and we're going to wind up slobbering on ourselves again later. And it either happens as a slow decline in life, or something dramatic happens, and we lose those capabilities. And so for me, the things that were undeveloped as a Green Beret were those love and compassion elements, the element of service and sacrifice, some of the things that weren't that developed were the only things I had left.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Next hour, Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others. He's been taking a look at this new report on guns in Chicago, just out from the city of Chicago. Right now, in downstate Illinois, Effingham County, want to welcome from the board there, David Campbell is with us. David, how are you, sir?
Doing well. How are you doing, Cam?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming to the program. It's good talking with you. And I saw this updated map here as of a couple of days ago. And if I counted correctly, David, y'all are up to, 32 counties now in Illinois that have passed one of these Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions.
We've got a new one since last night. Adams County is added to that as well. It's over on the west, almost central west side of the state. And we're up to 33 counties. Two cities, and we've got a lot of them right behind them ready to do it as well.
Well, I was going to say, we're looking at this map here, so just so folks know, those counties in green, those are counties that have actually approved this ordinance. The counties in yellow are going to be considering this ordinance very soon, and then the counties in orange have also taken a look at this, or maybe in the early stages. And those counties in red are the ones where there's been no action taken here. So, I mean, you can see, David, I mean, you're all the way up, not quite to the northern border, but, you know, there's a good chunk of the state, particularly in central and southern Illinois now, that is gone green. And they're really only a smattering of these red counties across the state that haven't even considered this proposal.
We're really excited with this map. It just goes to show you how many people are are so behind the Second Amendment and our constitutional rights. When we first started this, we only thought, you know, we were just making a statement for Effingham County, but it's just growing and growing and growing. Christian County, it's really helped us, you know, cultivate some of these other counties, and Iroquois as well. I mean, a lot of them are, I mean, we all work together now. It's almost like we've got a camaraderie of trying to get everybody to join in. And we, well, as you see, we've got almost a third of the state now, and several other ones ready to fall in.
Well, and you know you're making an impact, Dave, because I saw the story here a couple of days ago. A growing number of gun sanctuary counties in Illinois sparks concerns. Concerns among gun control advocates, according to the Illinois News Network. Mark Walls from the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence says, while this is quote-unquote symbolic, it also sends a message to people that these groups think gun ownership is more important than protecting human life. So David, I want to ask you to respond to that. Is that what this resolution is all about, demonstrating that gun ownership is more important than protecting human life?
Not at all. Not at all. The sanctuary part actually came in when our governor and our representatives decided to make the state of Illinois an illegal a place where illegal immigrants could come in and make it a sanctuary for them. So we wanted to fire back, and that's kind of why this whole thing was born with a sanctuary for guns. We wanted to give all our legal, law-abiding citizens a place to go and feel like they could be safe owning their firearms. So that's why we started this. And I would tell Mr. Walsh, you know, basically, what I don't think he understands is that guns are probably used 80 times more often to save lives than take lives. So I'm going to throw that right back at him.
Well, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, I imagine in Effingham County, along with, you know, most other counties across the state of Illinois, one of the reasons why people own firearms is because they care about human life. They care about their own. They care about the lives of their family, their friends, and even strangers. If they were ever in a position where they needed to defend the life of another, I don't know how many concealed carry holders you have there in Effingham County, but I imagine the number is growing by the day. And those are folks that I have no doubt would not only use their firearm in defense of themselves, but also in defense of another.
I agree 100%. And, you know, I mean, that's what it's all about, promoting safe and legal gun ownership. And we want law-abiding citizens to give them a place to feel like they're safe and exercising their Second Amendment rights. And that's the whole key of why we started this movement. And as you can see, it's growing even out of Illinois. It's growing into some other states. Oregon's really taken off, and I get calls from the state of Washington, and there's several other ones out there that are in the process of doing this. So Oregon's looking pretty good on their map, too. They're growing by leaps and bounds, too, with this. So not just Illinois, but I want to talk about Illinois because that's where I'm from.
Well, and as you say, I mean, this is really a grassroots endeavor, and this is something that, you know, I'm glad to hear that it's catching on, because this is something that we as gun owners can do. We can, there's nothing stopping us from going to our county commission meetings and asking our county commissioners, hey, you know, I don't know if you see what's going on here in these other counties, but here's a draft of this resolution. I would really love it if you all would consider this too. We can do this no matter where we live. Now, we might not be successful, but we can start that conversation. And frankly, David, you know, again, we're seeing gun control advocates. They're showing up at school board meetings. They're showing up at county commission meetings. They're showing up anywhere they think they can advance their agenda. And as gun owners and as Second Amendment supporters, we need to be doing the same thing.
I agree. We have to. It's not easy. I mean, everybody, you've got to start showing up at these meetings and standing up for your Second Amendment rights. It's a key element in making this whole thing work. And as you can see, it took off. We're in it a little over 2 months, and you can see in 2 months we've got almost a third of the state of Illinois. So little work you put into it, it takes off, and it will, you know, it just catches on like wildfire from there. You get everybody else involved and start the process and help them along and have maps like this to show how the growth, you know, growth is going. It just catches on.
Talking again with David Campbell. And David, I got to ask, I mean, now that it's been a little while since you all did this in Effingham County, has there been any pushback? Are you worried that you're going to get voted out of office for this? What's been the response from residents there?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely been some pushback on a local level. We usually have, we've got a county board meeting today at 4 o'clock, and there'll be probably anywhere from a dozen to 20 people there that are against guns, and they've been pretty vocal about it and trying to get me out of office. I'm up for my seat this November, and they put some people in to try to get myself and our board chairman out. And we'll see what happens. I think in the long run, I think people stand up for Second Amendment rights, and I think I'll retain my seat. I hope.
Well, I wish you well, David. And but again, I mean, that's interesting that I just said they're showing up everywhere they think they can advance their agenda. Even in Effingham County, they're showing up there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why we've got to take the Second Amendment people, and they have to get out there and counteract this now. Why these other ones are acting and just counteract what they're trying to do.
Absolutely.
And, we've had some good. And one thing I did want to bring up too, we're excited here in Effingham. Thursday, we are actually going to get a visit from Oliver North here in Effingham. He's going to be here from 5 to 9 to visit.
Really?
He's going to actually help promote 3 of our representatives that are strong gun advocates. And also, you know, just sit and he's going to actually be here and talk to, I think there's going to be close to 1,000 people at this. So we're excited about Oliver coming here to town.
That's awesome. Well, see, and there you go. You got 12 anti-gunners showing up at your county commission meetings, and you're going to have 1,000 people showing up to hear Oliver North. David Campbell. There in Effingham County. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program today. It's so good talking with you.
Good to talk with you, Cam, and keep up the good work. We appreciate it.
I will give our best to Colonel North, and we'll talk to you soon.
We'll do it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Again, David Campbell out there in Effingham County, Illinois. It's interesting, though. The gun control advocates are showing up there, right? Running a candidate, trying to get him out. Now, it's possible that anti-gun candidate loses by, 40 points on Election Day. Possibly they only lose by 20. It's possible they only lose by 10. A lot of that, again, is contingent on what we as gun owners do between now and Election Day. And, look, here's the thing. For a lot of us, we've got lives to live, right? It's the summer. Kids are out. Maybe you're having to take them to the summer camps. Maybe you're able to hang out at home with them. Maybe you're going on family vacations. And then school's going to start up again. And life's going to get crazy. They're going to be the football practices and softball practices. It's going to be homework every night. Can't really go to these meetings. I mean, again, we're always going to have an excuse. And they're legit excuses not to get involved because we're busy. We have lives. A lot of us have families. A lot of us have jobs. A lot of us have things that take us away from activism. But we got to carve out some time because the folks who don't really see our right to keep and bear arms as a right. They're carving out that time. The folks who believe that banning the most commonly sold rifle in America today is quote unquote commonsensical, they're carving out time. And, we can huff and puff and say, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, it can matter. I mean, ask the folks in Deerfield, Illinois, if it matters. Ask the folks in Piscataway, New Jersey, if it matters, or heck, residents across New Jersey, or out in California. Our involvement matters, and I doubt you're ever gonna be able to dedicate as much time as the professional protesters, those who seem to be at every protest. They've got their pre-made signs. Those folks who showed up outside of the Supreme Court, like within minutes of Brett Kavanaugh being nominated by President Trump, and they threw away their Kethledge signs and their Barrett signs, and they picked the right one to use to protest. You don't have to be that. You don't. I don't want you to be that, to be honest with you. But if you can find an hour a week, if you can find one evening every 2 weeks to go to a county commission meeting. The next time around, maybe you go to the school board meeting. Whatever you can do to be more involved and more engaged, it's not just helpful right now. It's needed. It's necessary. Because there are fights that are taking place on these fronts, regardless of whether or not you show up. And when you don't, it makes it even harder for the folks who do show up to fight that fight. They need those reinforcements. All right, so coming up next hour, Rob O'Donnell's going to join us from Brothers Before Others. We're going to talk with John Fund of National Review, who says Democrats are dumping moderates
You saw the video, right, Cameron, that was making the rounds this weekend of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked about the Palestinian or the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Yes, it's a thing. It is a thing, for sure.
It is a thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. If you haven't seen the clip, it's about 90 seconds long, and it's you know, she refers to the Palestinian occupation, and the host asks her, well, what does that mean exactly? And she says, well, it means that, you know, the places where the Israelis are building settlements, it's hard for the Palestinians to find housing and things like that. And the host just says, well, can you expound on that a little bit? And she says, well, haha, you know, I'm not an expert in geopolitics. Haha. But this was on her original, like, campaign platform, Cameron. I mean, this was part of her original plank. Here's the thing. If you don't know anything about this, then why say something about it? This goes, by the way, for both sides. We'll talk about that a little bit after a quick timeout. Stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up next.
I want to go back to what you talked about with the Constitution and what we are teaching and what we're not teaching. Because, you know, surrounding this gun control argument, it's not even really been a debate, but the argument over the last couple of months, I keep hearing, in fact, I saw it on my Twitter feed earlier today, one of these common talking points from anti-gun advocates is, well, listen, the Constitution's old, Lucretia. It was written in 1791, and founding fathers couldn't have envisioned what guns would look like. And by the way, back then, you know, that same Constitution, those same founding fathers, you talked about our freedom of speech and you talked about our right to keep and bear arms, they also said that you were three-fifths of a person. Right? And so why should we listen to the Constitution? Why should we hold this up as some sort of revered document when clearly it was written with flaws in it? We've changed, we've progressed, we've moved on past these things. Why can't we move past the Second Amendment, too?
Because our founding fathers were smarter than what we have in Washington today. It's like they had a crystal ball and they saw the tyranny that was going to happen 200 years later. So the only thing that is stopping us from losing our sovereignty, and the only thing stopping from Washington, D.C. from getting complete out control is the Bill of Rights, the Constitution of the United States. That's what's stopping them from taking us over from within. As long as we have the Constitution, we'll never be overtaken.
You know, and I'm so glad to hear you say that, because you're absolutely right. The Constitution, when it was presented to the American people back in 1787, there were a lot of people who were skeptical about it. There were a lot of people who said, whoa, this gives the federal government way, way too much power. I don't know if I'm on board with this, which is why we have a Bill of Rights. There were enough states that said, we're not going to ratify the Constitution unless we get some guarantees here that our rights are going to be protected. And if you read the preamble to the Bill of Rights, which nobody ever does, it actually talks about why we've got the Bill of Rights in the first place. They say to ensure that the government could not take these liberties, that to reassure the American people that their rights were going to be respected. That's why we have the Bill of Rights. And it's not that the government said, hey, you know what, we're putting together this whole new document. Let's come up with some new rights for you, too. These were rights that Americans already possessed. These were rights that Americans did not want to lose. And what we have seen over the past 230-plus years is that the rights have been expanded to include all Americans. It's true that at the time of the founding of this nation, basically people like me were the only ones who really got to exercise their rights.
Mm-hmm.
White guys who own property, right?
Who cares? Black men that own property. One of the first slave owners was a black man. If we're going to talk about history, let's go for tit for tat. You want to talk about all the evil in the world? Let's go back to Cain and Abel. Let's get serious. We live in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
We have a document that is a living, breathing document. Leave it alone. The first 12 amendments is the Bill of Rights. If you want to amend, you want to change it, then you go ahead and you amend it. But you're going to do it in order, in law, the way it's supposed to be. You're not going to get rid of the first 12 amendments. Let it go, because I will walk on Washington myself before I allow that to happen. I'm fighting for the next generation, and I could care less about what happened in the past, because we cannot go and change it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and here's the thing, but we have changed the present, we have changed the future, and what we have seen over our U.S. history is that expansion of rights, that recognition of, all right, you know what, it's not just a right of white guys who own property. It's not just a right of people, of men who own property. These rights are rights of all Americans. And you know what? I think the country has become a better place not a worse place, as more and more of us have been able to exercise our rights as Americans. And it does concern me that we now have people who are fighting to take those rights away, who say that, well, you know what, no, we were better off when we didn't have these rights. We were better off when we were able to say, you know what, you get to exercise that right, but you don't get to exercise that right.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. On the program this hour, Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others. City of Chicago out with a new report dealing with firearms there in the city of Chicago. Released just a couple of days ago. Rob's been digging into this report and says when you actually start taking a look at some of the facts and figures contained within, this doesn't exactly advance the gun control narrative the way that you might think that the city of Chicago would try to. This is the 2017 Gun Trace Report. Also, John Fund of National Review joins us on the program later on in the hour. His piece at National Review, Democrats are dumping moderates. And, you know, again, some of this is very, very visible. Witness the elevation of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to a national stage after her primary win over Joe Crowley in New York. Some of this is actually happening, I think, very much under the radar. We talked last week about three Democratic Socialist of America candidates for the state legislature in Pennsylvania, who won their primaries. Had you ever heard that before? I hadn't. I had not seen one national news story about that. But it is interesting. And then over the weekend, of course, the California Democrats, at their state convention, declining to endorse sitting U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. So the Democrats decided not to endorse their incumbent senator in her reelection campaign, and instead, and it wasn't even close. Like, that's the other amazing thing. It wasn't even like this was a nail biter for Dianne Feinstein. She only got like 7%, I think, of the delegate votes there at the state convention. And instead, California Democrats decided to endorse Kevin DeLeon, state senator, who gathered, I think it was about 12% of the vote in California's open primary earlier this year. Feinstein won that primary with 44% of the vote. So what does this mean? Again, I'm not sure it means as much in, let's say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's district or the state of California as it will mean if you are running as a Democrat in, let's say, Kentucky. Or upstate New York. We were talking past couple of days about what's going on in New York 21 with Tedra Cobb, the Democrat there, who says one thing in public. Actually, she says nothing about a gun ban in public, but in private, she'll admit, yes, I support a gun ban. I just can't say anything about it because if I do, I won't win the election. WWNY. TV, Channel 7, and WNYF, your North Country Fox, with a story on this actually today. Quote, we had a lot of reaction to our report about Democratic candidate for Congress, Tedra Cobb, caught on video saying she supports a ban on assault weapons but can't say so publicly because she'd lose. They just have a couple of brief viewer comments. One of them from a woman named Angie Walsh, guns are not the problem. The person with ill intentions are the real issue. Chris McRoberts, I can't believe a politician would say one thing in public, yet something totally different to a private group. Color me shocked. I figured Chris might have been a little sarcastic there. And here's the thing. If this is par for the course, yeah, well, that's kind of what I would expect. You're probably not going to be outraged by this. But usually at least be willing to take notice, right? So again, how are the moves by the Democratic Party nationally to appeal to a base that is excited and energized by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez
and excited and energized, I think to a lesser degree by Kevin DeLeon, but just excited and energized by the idea of getting Dianne Feinstein out of there and replacing her with somebody younger and even more progressive. How does this play in a lot of these battleground districts and a lot of these red states that Democrats are having to defend in November? And we talked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez over the weekend. This is the clip where she was asked about her comments on the Palestinian occupation. Just listen, this is about a minute or so long. Take a look and listen.
But I am, of course, the dynamic there in terms of geopolitics and the war in the Middle East is very different than people expressing their First Amendment right to protest.
Well, yes, but I also think that what people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is just an increasing crisis of humanitarian condition. And that to me is just where I tend to come from on this issue.
You use the term the occupation of Palestine. What did you mean by that?
I think what I meant is like the settlements that are increasing in some of these areas and places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty in access to their housing and homes.
Do you think you can expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd also just, I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue.
Okay. Yeah, interesting, because by the way, that typically refers to the you know, occupation of Palestine, typically refers to, Cameron, the fact that Israel exists, right? Isn't that generally how that's used, like Israel is occupying land that should be Palestine?
I mean, you'll never, I'm as pro-Israel Zionist as it gets. You will never get me to believe the Palestinian side or go on their side for anything. But I would at least respect someone who could have a real opinion on this. I mean, if you really are against the occupation or are anti-Israel, have a cogent thought, have a series of bullet points, have some sort of respectful idea of what the hell you're talking about. This woman is, it just sounds so typical. I mean, this is, and Tom Perez said, this is the future of the Democrat Party. Fine. If you want to be the future of the Democrat Party and you want to try to convince people that you're not anti-Israel and you're not anti-Semitic, this is not the way to go about it. Between this and this woman Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, who's probably going to win a seat there, who tweeted horrific things about Israel too. I mean, this is starting to look like the Labour Party of the UK a few years ago. This is bad stuff. But these people, they're putting all their eggs in this woman's basket, and she is. I mean, I would have respect for her. I mean, as much as like you talk about a Dianne Feinstein or something like that, at least Dianne Feinstein can elucidate and she can talk about issues. And you disagree as much as you want, but why do people see such hope and fervor in someone who's such a dummy?
Well, so what's interesting is, you know, when she was clearly, she had never been asked that question before. I never been asked, you know, what does that mean, the occupation, of Palestine? And I assume that I'm making an assumption here, but I assume that in the political circles that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez runs in, that's just how you talk, right? I mean, like, that's what you say. You talk about occupied Palestine. You talk about the occupation.
Cam, this is like every time we see a major march in Washington, right? One of our friends in conservative media will, without fail, go down and interview most of these people and ask them, what are you here for? Tell me the one thing about what you're marching against. Talk about it for a minute. And nobody can. They can just babble off one bullet point about that something they might have just read in a sign that walked by, and they don't know, they have no clue what they're talking about. And this, you're exactly right. This is the same thing. This is what her bartender friends in Brooklyn talked about, and it's just, it is, it's so awful to hear this woman speak, and it does nothing but damage. I mean, I I hate to say, you know, oh, go on with that line of thinking. Go on with that kind of candidate because it's going to damage your party. But at the end of the day, let's be realistic. She will be in Congress. And she will have a say in things. Not a huge say. I mean, she's a flash in the pan. She's not going to be a leader of a committee or a conference. But she'll have a say in things, and that's kind of frightening.
I'm telling you, when the Democrats take back the House, she's the Speaker. I'm telling you, they're dumping Dianne Feinstein. They're not endorsing Dianne Feinstein. She'll be drafted. She won't even have to run. She'll be drafted to be the next Speaker when Democrats take her. You know, and again, that could be in November. That could be 2 years from now. That could be 6 years from now. Because again, that's a pretty safe seat. So you're right. Not only is she probably going to get elected to Congress, she's probably going to be there as long as she wants. Right? I mean, she could be Bernie Sanders one day. She could be just, you know, white hair everywhere and just, you know, talking crazy socialist stuff. You know, 50 years from now.
You say that, Cam, but you remember Donna Edwards from Maryland? She was a real hardcore progressive that won from the D.C. suburbs of Maryland. They touted her as the next big thing, too. She was only there for 2 years because there was nothing behind her. And I hope and imagine that this will happen with Miss Ocasio-Cortez because at the end of the day, you know, you could put her on a pedestal and worship her. But when you listen to her talk, I would even hope that the most hardcore liberal thinks, that's not the kind of person I want representing me.
Wait, okay, now Wikipedia's been known to be wrong, but Wikipedia says she was there from 2008 to 2017, Donna Edwards.
Oh, then I had that wrong. I thought it was just a term or two at the most. Okay, then I am wrong on that one. But she came into Congress with this exact same bona fides.
Yeah, and she ran for U.S. Senate in 2016 in the primary to replace Barbara Mikulski. Was defeated by Chris Van Hollen in the Democratic primary. Sponsored an amendment to the U.S. Constitution repealing Citizens United. A couple of years ago. So there you go. That was Donna Edwards. Look, maybe it won't be 50 years, but yeah, she'll probably be there a decade. Right. And, you know, look, here's the thing. There are a couple of issues. One, if you actually don't know about something and you're a candidate, maybe don't talk about it. Maybe just say, I'm not a geopolitical expert. Still studying up on the issue. I think especially if you're running for Congress, you're probably going to be able to get a pass on some of this stuff, right? And look, as a voter, would you rather have somebody bloviate to you? Would you rather have somebody say, you know, honestly, I don't know about that issue, or I don't know enough about that issue that I'm ready to make some sort of public proclamation? What do you know about that issue? I mean, I would rather have somebody say, yeah, I'm not really sure. Boy, there's a lot of stuff on both sides. But when you just, again, when you mindlessly repeat what you've heard, and it's clear that you're just mindlessly repeating what you've heard, that's a problem, right? So let's be fair here. Let's talk about problems on our side, too. I didn't see that Sacha Baron Cohen show on Showtime, but I saw some of the headlines over the weekend where gun rights supporters were basically punked into touting, if I understand this correctly, Cameron, a supposedly Israeli program arming kindergartners. I think it was the Kindergarten program.
Cam, I will say this too. I don't know if you saw my tweet about it, but I did not fall for the trick. I got emailed by these people.
Did you?
Would you like me to read the email to you?
Yes, please.
I didn't bring it up to you at the time because I thought it was just so ridiculous. This is from Ashley Winthrop. It's Ashley at JerusalemTV.com. And it said, media request for Cameron Gray, shoot on February 26th. To whom it may concern, as you may be aware, April 18, 2018 will mark the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Jewish State of Israel. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and the entire nation, along with her international allies, will be celebrating this historic milestone. It is my honor to inform you that Cameron Gray has been chosen as one of Israel's 70 at 70 for strong support of the State of Israel. Now listen, I'm proud to be a strong supporter of the state of Israel, but in the light of everything else, I'm pretty much a nobody. So the fact that I was chosen one of 70 people in the world was already the biggest red flag. But we go on. The 70 at 7 Awards highlights 70 distinguished individuals from outside Israel who have contributed to the defense and betterment of the nation. As a country in a uniquely vulnerable location, the people of Israel understand that they owe their very existence to the unwavering support of powerful figures like Cameron Gray. It's just, it gets better as it goes. In conjunction with this award, Jerusalem Television is producing a program tentatively titled called 70 at 7 that will be aired by DBS, the largest provider, TV provider in Israel, which instantly I go and Google DBS. No such thing. You'd think the largest TV provider in Israel would have a web page. Nothing.
You would think.
While the actual ceremony will not be until April 18th, our film crew will be in Washington, D.C. on February 26th and would like to present Cameron Gray with the award in person and conduct a one-hour sit-down interview. The interview will focus on the shared values between our countries and the work he has done to ensure those bonds remain as strong as ever. Here's the best part. We have already sat down with Tony Blair, Rupert Murdoch, Larry Ellison, Bono, and Steven Spielberg, among others. Even my most proud moment, I don't consider myself in that company. We would also like to discuss the mutual security interests of our countries as two beacons of democracy in a troubled world. The people of Israel believe that a government's most fundamental responsibility is to provide security for its citizens, and Cameron Gray has been a strong, consistent voice on this issue. Please let me know if he has any availability on the 26th, and we'll do everything we can to make this happen. I look forward to speaking with you soon. Thank you sincerely, Ashley Winthrop, producer, Jerusalem Television, which is JerusalemTV.com, which never existed. So, I didn't fall for it.
Unbelievable. Oh, my gosh. I would have thought the Bono would have gotten you. I would have thought that would have been like, well, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
That makes sense.
I see myself as the edge. I can hang.
Yeah. So here's the thing. You know, again, if something comes up and you're a candidate and you don't know anything about it, I think, look, I'm not a campaign manager. I've never run for office. But as a voter, I think it's better to just say, yeah, you know what? I'm not really fully informed on that issue. And I'm still learning about it. I don't really have an opinion. When you get an unsolicited email comparing you to Bono and Tony Blair, maybe do some research. But also, if you get there and they start talking about things that, you know, would make you uncomfortable, like, putting a stuffed animal / firearm in the hands of a 4-year-old, it's okay to walk away. It really is. It's okay just to get up and walk out. It's in fact, you should. You shouldn't do anything that you're uncomfortable with doing. You shouldn't say something you don't believe. That's pretty basic, right? Anyway, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, Rob O'Donnell with Brothers Before Others joins us. John Fund of National Review later in the hour. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy. And, I mean, I'm still so impressed. We're going to take a time out. I'm going to ask Cameron Gray for his autograph. I mean, that's like Bono. I mean, that's... it's amazing. All right, stick around. More Cameron Company's on the way.
Bristol Motor Speedway, the place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA and take in the best bumper-banging, fist-waving, hero-making short track race of the year, the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's night race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
It's as patriotic as it gets. A gathering in the heartland of folks from all 50 states. Welders, salesmen, farmers, accountants, soldiers, first responders. Here, we're all the same. Here, we are all race fans. We are proud of our country, proud of our military, proud of our drivers. We proudly stand for our national anthem, and we have a great reverence for names like Yarborough, Earnhardt, Waltrip, and Gordon. Yes, there are other NASCAR races, but this one is special. 500 temper flaring, finger waving, ego busting 15 second laps. And deep into the warm August night, hardly a seat in the last great Coliseum will be used. You see, this isn't just a race. This is America's night race.
My daughter came into the bedroom and she said, "Dad, there's a man in black tactical gear shooting up the Baptist church." Every one of those shots to me represented one of my neighbors, one of my friends. And I ran as fast as I could. Immediately, he came out of the church shooting at me. He hit the truck in front of me, hit the car behind me, hit the house behind me. And I hit him. He had an AR-15, but so did I. And it's not the gun, it's the heart. It's a matter of the heart. I'm not the bravest man in the world or anything, but I was here. I was here, and I could do something. And I had to do something.
I do know what it's like to be vulnerable. I know what it's like to feel like you can't protect your children or yourself. And it's terrifying when you have a spouse, whether it be husband or wife, that's serving overseas thousands of miles away, and you're the only one there to stand up for yourself, to stand up for your home, for your little kid that's right there next to you. I support the Second Amendment because of that. I support the NRA because they support my right to protect my kids. Everybody has a right to life, and you have the right to protect that. And nobody has the right to take it away from you.
Second Amendment in the U.S. Constitution is very personal for me. When the people came to the streets and demonstrated against the regime, demanding their own rights, they get cracked on by the violence of the government. The people get tortured, executed, assassinated, hanging the people in the streets. These things I saw with my eyes. That's part of my experience. Just imagine if you get successful, you remove your Second Amendment from your Constitution completely. But who knows, in 20 years, 25 years, maybe situation get changed. But any single person should have a right to defend themselves and defend their families.
Welcome back to Cam & Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. An hour from now, Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom. Right now, joining us from Brothers Before Others, Rob O'Donnell is with us. Rob, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Cam. How are you, sir?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. It's been a rough few days for our police officers around the country, and obviously our thoughts and our prayers are with every single one of them. On the streets, protecting and serving our communities right now. I talked with you a little bit on Friday. You had been looking at this gun trace report by the City of Chicago, Office of the Mayor, the Chicago Police Department, and you said that there was some interesting stuff in there, some stuff that's sort of counterfactual to the standard gun control talking point. So first of all, what exactly is this 2017 gun trace report? What does this cover?
What the Gun Trace Report does is from 2013 to 2017, the Chicago Police Department extrapolated all illegal guns that came in their contact, that's illegal possession or used in any crime, and they did a data point on their original point of sale and how they were obtained and such. What the report turns out being is an ends to a means. They knew what their goal was when they wrote the report, and they basically filled it with data to get there. And the more I look into the report, the more I dig into the the notations that they put in the end of where they got their data from and where they extrapolated some of their reporting for facts, it just keeps on peeling onions, layers of onions, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. So in the preface to this report, they lay out and sort of the five pillars. They say that Rahm Emanuel had announced as his public safety strategy, right? Strengthening law enforcement resources, including hiring 970 new officers and providing training and technology to support Chicago Police Department's crime fight. Now, we're going to come back to that. Investments in violence prevention, including evidence-based mentoring, academic support programs, and restorative justice principles in Chicago public schools. Legislation to address gun violence, including increased criminal penalties for high-risk gun offenders and licensure requirements for necessary oversight over Illinois gun dealers, which is a bill that Governor Rauner announced today he will be vetoing. Economic development and employment opportunities to treat the root causes of violence, including an expansion of job programming and support services, financial incentives in economically stagnant neighborhoods, and investment opportunities to attract jobs. Building community trust and legitimacy between the Chicago Police Department and communities that they serve, including sweeping police reform measures, accountability, transparency, and de-escalation training, as well as a new culture of community policing within the department. All five pillars of the strategy, the mayor says, are essential to address gun violence in Chicago. So, Rob, what exactly has the city done? I mean, one of the things that you've been tweeting out today is you go back and you look at the homicide totals in Chicago. And look, they were, you know, never great, but they were on the way down from, you know, where they were in the 70s, 80s, early 90s. And then they started going up again under Mayor Rahm Emanuel. What happened, in your opinion, that made the homicide rate shoot up in Chicago? Was it did some big Second Amendment law pass in Illinois? Was that, you know, right around the same time the right to carry happened? Are these concealed carry holders that are you know, causing mayhem in Chicago? What's going on?
Well, what happened, and in all factuality, is the Obama administration is in this anti-police Department of Justice handcuffed the police. Crime levels, as far as homicides went, were at the levels of the 1960s. And then Rahm Emanuel became the mayor and disbanded the Chicago Police Department's most aggressive, proactive units that sole purpose was to find gangbangers with guns, to find the illegal guns off the street, to remove the illegal guns off the street. You know, but based on the rhetoric from the administration that, you know, the police are overzealous and they're doing wrong things, it directly correlates to this spike in crime. You know, as soon as that happened, you know, you let 1 or 2 years go by from that inaction and the community to realize, hey, the police aren't looking for us with guns anymore, and your homicide rates with firearms and in general started skyrocketing.
All right. So they also point out where the firearms that were recovered were originally sold. They say that federally licensed Illinois dealers primarily located in suburban Cook County, the original point of purchase for approximately 2 out of every five crime guns recovered in Chicago. They say this proportion is nearly identical to what was observed in previous trace data from 2009 to 2013. So, you know, there's obviously gun control activists talk about, well, the reason why we need, you know, Chicago-style gun laws in Virginia is because the guns come in from Virginia. This actually demonstrating that these guns aren't really traveling far. We know that criminals are primarily obtaining firearms, Rob, through theft, through family and friends, through things like, you know, straw purchases, things that are already against the law. This would indicate that that's happening there in Chicago.
Absolutely. And what drew my attention to this report, you know, was someone using that data where 60% of all the guns used in Chicago come from outside the city area. Well, that's because Chicago hasn't had a gun store during the time that this study took place. So, of course, all guns came from out of the Chicago area. But once you extrapolate that further, it says 2 out of every five gun crimes are committed with guns purchased in Illinois. Local people buy guns from their local stores. Criminals don't commute to commit crimes. They steal those guns. What gets me with this report is they consider illegal transactions, and that's how they label it, the theft, burglary, or robbery of these firearms. So if you're a legal gun owner and your house is robbed or you're robbed in the street and your gun is removed, they consider that an illegal transaction. And they paint this in to the portrait of, you know, let's do universal background checks. Let's look into curtailing the straw purchases, which I've shown again, you know, they try and direct this towards the straw purchases, a main problem, people buying the guns legally and shipping them in. But their own history on this is failing to prosecute or go after these people aggressively with the current laws they have on the books. And until they do that, you really can't come to justifiably say, hey, we need more additional layers of laws here, because you have the laws that you're not already addressing.
Talking again with Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others. Now, what about the policing that's taking place in Chicago, Rob? I mean, in Rahm Emanuel's five pillars, he talks about hiring more officers, more training. He also talks about community policing and de-escalation techniques. What has changed in terms of the policing in the city of Chicago from when violent crime and homicides were declining to when they shot up again?
It's that balance that we've talked about time and time again of the proactive policing versus the reactive policing. He basically handcuffed his police department. He gave in to the Department of Justice oversight on rhetoric of these proactive law enforcement is discriminatory, it's racist, and you're not having that aggressive, hey, that support structure from the higher-ups in the mayor's office and the police department saying, hey, we need to get these guns off the street. I guarantee you, if you supported a police department there with their proactive policing, respectful proactive policing that went after criminals and targeted criminals, you'd start to see the same reductions that we have in the past.
Do you think that it's likely to happen in Chicago under the current leadership, or is that going to require, you know, a change in political attitude there in Chicago?
I believe that you're going to need an administration change with the support structure, like happened in New York under Mayor Dinkins to Giuliani, where, you know, it was the same microcosm of what's going on in Chicago. And in their report, they even compare themselves to New York, saying, look how worse we are. Well, there's a structure in place. There's a history in place in New York that shows this is successful. It shows it works. Not reports like this where and let me get into the how the notations they make to go for their universal background checks, where they say, hey, we need this because of this study. I looked into one of the studies, and it was the 2015 firearms acquisition without background checks, results of a national survey. Now, I looked into that survey, and it was done by the American College of Physicians did that study that they're using for a gun control, a gun policy. It basically states out of 1,600 adults that they spoke with for that study that 22% didn't have background checks. Well, if you dig into that further, a large portion of them were family transfers where somebody gave their gun to their brother, somebody gave their gun firearm to a son or daughter. And if you look at it further, that study was funded by the Joyce Foundation and the Fund for a Safer Future, both known North Midwestern anti-gun groups that support policies of gun control and anti-gun policies. So basically you have two anti-gun groups or gun control groups funding a study through the American College of Physicians that a municipality used to justify more gun control.
All right. Now, this report also gets into recommendations, Rob, and they have a whole host of gun control recommendations, as you might well imagine. I want to ask you, from a law enforcement perspective, one of the things that they talk about is a quote-unquote comprehensive background checks on private sales in Illinois, which is already, I understand, the law. But they also talk about, quote, effective enforcement of Illinois' lost and stolen reporting law. They write, in 2013, a coalition of law enforcement agencies and anti-violence advocates, reads gun control advocates, successfully passed a lost and stolen reporting law in Illinois. And again, this is another piece of do-something legislation. They say, this is the city of Chicago writing, lost and stolen reporting laws are designed to mitigate a straw purchaser or illegal firearm traffickers' ability to make false claims to law enforcement when the paper trail or other information can successfully trace a crime gun back to the unlawful seller. The current Illinois law requires a person to report to law enforcement, quote, within 72 hours of obtaining knowledge
of a firearms loss or a theft. Failure to do so is a petty offense, punishable by a ticket only and a Class A misdemeanor for a second or subsequent violation. City of Chicago says the Illinois General Assembly could take simple steps to more effectively enforce and implement the lost and stolen reporting law. First, they say the violation should result in a criminal offense eligible for arrest, not simply a ticket. And any person who fails to report the loss or theft of multiple firearms should have his or her FOID card suspended or revoked. The current penalty structure allows a gun trafficker to receive multiple violations, keep his or her FOID card, and continue to legally buy guns for dissemination in the illegal market. Now, there's more, but let's just stop there for a second, Rob. As the city of Chicago noted, this law was passed with the help of gun control advocates and you know, Chicago area police chiefs and things of that nature. That was the coalition that got this lost or stolen bill passed through the legislature. If that's what they wanted, if that's what they need now to, in order to enforce this, make this an arrestable offense, not a petty offense, why didn't they ask for it to begin with?
Well, just like any other gun laws, let's get what we can get while we can get it. The same thing with the rifles and the AR platforms that are under attack now. This study clearly states that rifles are under 5%, 4.8%, I believe, as opposed to over 90% of handguns. But yet the national discussion on firearms gun control right now is this scary AR platform variant rifle. So they're going to grasp at what they can get. Like right now, the gun control groups are working off of fear because of the minuscule incidents where AR platform firearms have been used to grab at all of these semi-automatic rifles, when in all actuality, they're not the problem when it comes to gun control as a whole.
All right. Now, there are other suggestions for this, quote, lost or stolen bill. They say, second, as current law stands, there's ample room for straw purchasers and firearm traffickers to skirt law enforcement without citation or conviction. Because law enforcement is required to establish that the person had, quote, knowledge of the loss or theft, an offender can still misrepresent that he or she did not know the firearm went missing and avoid sanction even after an outlandish amount of time has passed. A rebuttable presumption should be written into the law that presumes knowledge of a firearm's loss or theft after a reasonable period of time after the firearm goes missing. With this change, if law enforcement can demonstrate that a gun has long been in the illegal stream of commerce or recovered at a crime scene months or years prior, the person cannot claim ignorance and avoid accountability. Such a measure, quote, protects responsible gun owners who are already likely to immediately report a lost or stolen gun. Does this not establish a presumption of guilt? Then, I mean, it sounds like what they're saying, Rob, is, you know, it's really hard to enforce because people can just say, well, I didn't know my gun was lost or stolen until they get a call. And so because it's hard to enforce, because people can just say that, we should just make it illegal for them to say that and basically just say, hey, you know what, if your gun shows up at a crime scene and you didn't report a lost or stolen, we're just going to assume that that you did know, and it'll be up to you to prove that you did not. Now, if it's tough for the prosecutors to prove that these individuals knowingly did not report their gun lost or stolen, how hard is it going to be for the gun owner to prove that that they didn't know that their gun had gotten stolen or had gone missing?
Absolutely, and that's where they really don't care. They're going to take the lawful gun owner who was victimized by a burglary, robbery, or theft, that their gun was stolen or robbed or taken by illegal means, they're already a victim, and make them a victim again by charging them with this crime. As far as the straw purchase, I have an issue with their straw purchase focus on this report throughout. They keep bringing the straw purchase up and how this is a major problem, but yet when they check, over 93% of these guns are traced back to someone who's only bought one gun. So one would think that if someone was in the business of making money by doing straw purchases, and how straw purchase works for those who don't know is, you know, I go buy a gun legally because I can for $500. I'm going to sell it to a drug dealer or a friend of mine who's a gangbanger for $700 and make $200 off of it, because that's how that business works. If you're only buying one gun, if out of all these guns taking 93% of them or 94% of them were traced back to only one buyer, I don't see it as the focus point is that they're trying to make it to be. One would think that if I was in the straw purchase business, I'd have 30, 40, 50 guns that would eventually be linked back to me. And with the amount of guns they're taking off the street for these crimes, you would think more than 94% would go back to just one buyer.
Yeah, you would think. Rob, listen, I appreciate you taking a look at this report and breaking it down with us. Unfortunately, we've got to take a time out, but I look forward to talking again here very soon, sir.
Have a great day.
You too. Rob O'Donnell, brothersbeforeothers.org is the website. That is a nonprofit charitable organization that is primarily law enforcement officers helping the family of fallen officers. I know that they're busy right now, but they do accept help from non-LEOs as well. All right, when we return, John Fund is going to be with us from National Review talking about Democrats dumping moderates from coast to coast. Well, mostly coasts, but a little bit here and there in the hinterlands as well. We'll break it down with John Fund right after a quick timeout. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company still on the way.
One Million Moms Against Gun Control. What I was going to say, what's your organization all about? But I think it's right there in the title. You're against gun control. So let me just go down the line and ask you, why do you belong to this organization? Why are you a part of 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control, Mary?
Right after Newtown, when Shannon Watts came out as, you know, 1 Million Moms for gun control, I'm like, wait a minute, wait, you know, looking online, I needed to, you know, to go with the guns. I'm like, we're not against guns. I need guns to protect my family, and came across this organization and joined that because I'm like, she's not going to speak for me, and she's not going to speak for my fellow moms that are, you know, for guns and the value that they hold as a tool to defend my family and myself if something bad were to happen. So I'm like, nope, we got to join this organization. We got to get involved and do something about it.
That's awesome. What about you, Melissa?
Well, I tag along with them. Sharing my story of what I've been through, what I survived through, and supporting them. We, you know, we've grown up around guns our whole life, and just never being afraid, but also educating people on the importance of them as well.
Yeah.
And not letting, you know, not telling them that they're a bad thing. And she's given me more education, you know, growing up and just even now after everything that I've been through and, you know, how important things are. So I tag along. They kind of, you know, give me out to people.
And share how important it is as a personal thing to see what she went through. And this is why we encourage women to carry, because her story is so powerful. You know, in your own home to get attacked, no one ever thinks they're going to get attacked in the safest place. And that's why you need a gun for protection. You know, her story is literally why we do this now, you know, even more passionate about it.
You know, when you walk into a house where you were stabbed 17 times, where you were beaten within an inch of your life, you know, and it's a hard thing to swallow, but I have continued to make myself stronger through it all and educate people. I speak in high schools to young women. I speak to ladies all over. I have people that contact me from across the country. And it becomes a very empowering thing, especially for a woman. There's a lot of women out there that we've had these conversations when it comes to getting your concealed carry.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they feel intimidated being with men and going and doing that. But I try to share with people that just because you're a woman doesn't mean you can't be empowered, doesn't mean you can't be something awesome. So after my attack, I've continued to do this. I still deal with a lot of things, but, you know, coming here, doing this, talking to different people, it helps.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're here.
Well, thank you.
And I want to ask you some more questions, but I also I don't want to neglect Shannon and Rebecca. So, Shannon, how did you get involved in the organization?
Yeah, really, it was an accidental thing. Scrolling through Facebook, saw another friend of mine that I was friends with on Facebook had liked the page, so I looked into it and I said, "That's for me. That is absolutely for me." I have a young son; he's 7 years old, and so. At that time, after Newtown happened, I was a stay-at-home mom, so I was going out doing errands with him and stuff. And I realized this is something that I really need to advocate for because I don't want to be out with him knowing I can't do a thing to protect him at all.
Yeah.
And at home, and I'm alone at home a lot with my son, so I want to make sure that all women are able to effectively protect themselves and feel empowered enough to be able to do so.
And Rebecca, what about you?
Generally speaking, I have been around guns my entire life. I hunt and I do all the things that a girl from Kansas does. So you go out and you target practice and things like that. When I had children of my own, I really started to understand what it means to be responsible for the protection of someone that is defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
When Shannon Watts came out and started saying that she spoke for all mothers, I knew that she didn't speak for me. And I knew that she didn't speak for a great many of us. It is very important to me because I need all of us and our children to have a voice. The attack on our individual liberty, not just guns for sports, guns for hunting, but just the attack on individual liberty is incessant, and we have to stand together. We have to speak out. And being moms, we're the ones that are most often with our children. If they are going to learn about their rights, they need to learn it at home from us.
Welcome back. Cam and Company continues here on NRA TV. An hour from now, John Cardillo joins us talking about the attacks on law enforcement nationwide over the weekend. Not coordinated by any nature, but just a continued reminder of how dangerous that profession is and the support that they need. Now, join us on the program right now from National Review. John Fund is with us, at John Fund on Twitter. John, how are you, sir?
Pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. I appreciate you coming on the program. This was surprising to me, and there's not much about California politics that can surprise me anymore, but over the weekend, California Democrats endorsing in the Senate race, not incumbent Dianne Feinstein, but her challenger, Kevin De Leon. And, John, as you write, I mean, this wasn't even close. 65% of the State Democratic Party's 330-member executive committee voted to spurn Dianne Feinstein. He won 65% of party activists. Feinstein got just 7%. This is pretty amazing, John.
Well, remember, both Dianne Feinstein, who's been senator since 1992, and her challenger, Kevin De Leon, who's a state senator, are going to be on the ballot in November. California has an unusual two-tier primary. The top two from the primary, where all the candidates appear on the same ballot, go on to November. So Feinstein is still the favorite. But the Democratic Party, and 70% of Democrats voted for her in the primary, the Democratic Party's activist base, its executive committee, its leadership, has gone so far left, they've repudiated her now, and they are now backing a candidate who wants to abolish ICE, wants to have socialized medicine, wants to pull out of Guantanamo, wants to have tax increases on everything, abolish the death penalty, you name it, all the litany of the socialist left playbook. And it's astonishing just how far left the activist base of the Democratic Party is going. And it's not just California. That's just the leading edge.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I mean, you know, it's interesting. So Dick Durbin had that quote a couple of days ago where he was talking about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. And, you know, he says the base wants us to go and shut down the Senate. He says they don't really understand. There's not a lot that we can do. These folks on the executive committee, these aren't political neophytes, right? They may be very much grassroots activists in California, but they also are engaged in the political system itself. And yet they said, hey, you know what? The future is not Dianne Feinstein. The future is Kevin De Leon. The future is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We've talked about, you know, even at the state representative level, in places like Pennsylvania, I think that there are three Democratic socialists who won their primary fights around the Pittsburgh area, and they're going to be, you know, competing to win a state legislative seat. So it may be primarily happening in the coast, but clearly this is a phenomenon that is pushing the Democrat Party to the left all across the country.
You make an excellent point, and one of the interesting things is the amount of resources the Democratic Party is going to spend on this. You know, by getting this endorsement of the state Democratic Party, Kevin De Leon, the radical leftist, he's going to get slate cards, which say vote for him rather than Feinstein. He's going to get lots of access to emails of Democratic Party members so he can bombard them with messages. And he's going to get a share of the money that Democrats raise nationally for Senate races. California will get a prorated share, and that will go to him rather than Dianne Feinstein. Now, she'll have plenty of money. But it's astonishing to see Democrats pour resources into a race where, regardless of who wins in November, it will be a Democrat. And they insist on giving money and resources to the most left-wing Democrat.
talking to you with John Fond of National Review. So how do you think, John, this is going to play out in the general election? Clearly Democrats are hoping that that this will appeal to younger voters, that they can, generate large turnout, get that blue wave going. But as you say, these are things that the ideas, the ideology and the philosophies behind some of these candidates are something that don't typically resonate in, the America's heartland.
Well, you're going to have a lot of cross currents in this November election. You have 10 states where their Democratic senators running, where Trump won their state. And obviously a lot of this messaging on the national level, even though those individual state candidates aren't running on those issues, it taints the entire Democratic ticket. On the other hand, on the House side, control of the House is going to be determined by the 24 House districts that Hillary Clinton carried, but also elected a Republican representative in 2016. And that's going to be tougher. It certainly is true that some Republicans may say, well, I don't like Donald Trump. Donald Trump isn't my cup of tea, but I'm not going to vote for these crazies. So they may not vote. They may vote third party. They may decide to stick with the Republican incumbent. I don't think this is going to make a major difference in the election, but on the margins, what you have is all the mainstream media saying Trump is extreme, but at the same time, they're ignoring the fact that Democrats are, in their Trump derangement syndrome, going off the far left edge of the planet.
Yeah, there is that. Talking again with John Fond of National Review. And, John, I guess maybe the next big question is, we saw over the weekend Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asked about a comment that she had made during that same interview about the occupation of Palestine. And it became pretty apparent, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez really couldn't speak on that issue. She even said, I'm not a geopolitical expert. How much, deep dives and how much digging are we going to get from the media into what makes an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez different than a Joe Crowley? What makes Kevin DeLeon more appealing right now to California Democrats, at least those on the executive committee, than Dianne Feinstein? Are we going to get that type of, here's what's new, here's what's different, here's why these activists are so motivated for these candidates and not the quote-unquote establishment Democrats?
Well, it hasn't happened yet. And I think we're paying a price for the fact that our public schools for the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War haven't taught anything about why we fought the Cold War, why communism was bad, why socialism, which is its sister cousin, is also bad. Even though there's socialist economies failing all over the world, Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, they're rarely attacked in those terms. They're usually just called authoritarian or totalitarian countries. The actual fact that they're going down the drain because of socialism isn't mentioned. As a result, millennials are much more willing to consider the word socialism because they're unhappy with the economic system today, the fewer job opportunities that they have. They're not rising as fast and paying off the enormous student loans they have as they would like. So we have a problem. A bunch of people saying we're democratic socialists, Bernie Sanders being chief among them. And I find it astonishing, given the failure of socialism around the world, that we have younger people especially willing to listen to them. I think we need a real education project. We need to tell people not just that socialism is bad, but democratic socialism isn't any different, because ultimately, if you control the means of production, you're going to control the people. And I think that we have to go back to the educational system. If the public schools won't teach the difference, we all have to launch our own educational efforts and hope as many kids as possible go to private school and homeschool.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, because if you ask somebody who describes themselves as a democratic socialist, well, what is that exactly? They'll tell you, John, don't you like public roads? Don't you like firefighters? Don't you like police officers? Don't you like teachers? Well, that's all democratic socialism is. To which my response is, if that's all it was, you wouldn't need to call yourself a democratic socialist. You could just call yourself a Democrat or an American. What is really democratic socialism, John?
Well, Bernie Sanders likes to think it's Sweden. Well, I've been to Sweden recently. I also appeared on a panel at a conference discussing Sweden Today, Sweden today has over half of its children attending private schools using vouchers. Sweden today may have some higher tax rates because they provide more government services, but the government owns almost nothing, almost none of the companies that they used to own 40 or 50 years ago. So while Sweden may have had socialistic elements 50 years ago, it doesn't have them today. Neither does Denmark, neither does Norway, neither does Finland. So what they're pining for doesn't exist anymore. Those countries have moved away from social democracy to, yes, a mixed economy, but almost completely capitalist in terms of where people work outside of the government. And I think that what they're falling back on is they really don't want to defend the socialism of Venezuela and Cuba because that's indefensible. So they have this muddle of democratic socialism, but they can't really point to a country today where it's really working. They don't exist.
That's right. That's what they fall back on. Well, it's never really been tried.
Marxism was a great idea, but it was perverted by its implementers like Joe Stalin. He just, you know, didn't run the dials properly, didn't turn the dials properly, and we ended up with a mess.
Right.
But we're going to get it right the next time.
Yeah. If they get it wrong, though, boy, there's an awful human price to pay. Hey, John, listen, we are out of time, unfortunately, but thank you so much, sir, for coming to the program.
Thank you.
Really appreciate the column at Nash Review as well.
Thank you.
You bet. All right, coming up, Hour 3, we have today's Hero of the Day. We have our Deal of the Day. We have our Good Guy as well, plus Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom join us. John Cardillo is going to join us as well, coming up in Hour 3 from the Rebel and Newsmax TV. We'll talk about some of the attacks on law enforcement across the nation over the weekend, including in Massachusetts, again, another attack on a police officer by an individual well known to law enforcement. A lengthy criminal record. Plenty of opportunities to put this individual behind bars. And unfortunately, it's not what happened. And Weymouth police officer Michael Chesna was killed Sunday after a suspect attacked him with a rock, then took his firearm, shot him in the head and in the chest. A unidentified woman was also fatally wounded by at least one of those shots traveling to a nearby home. That was in Massachusetts. Also got attacks on the law enforcement in Kansas City and elsewhere. Stick around. We're going to talk about it coming up in Hour 3 right here on Cam & Company.
Yesterday, we were actually talking with an individual who's living out of a school bus, and he's driving around the country and specifically hunting on public land because he's trying to raise awareness about, you know, access issues and why public hunting land is so important. Is this a big issue for you as well?
Yeah, I would say it's in the top of the issues. Because, you know, I grew up in Montana, and I've watched over the period of time roads being shut down over and over. And what that does is not everyone has 7 days to go into backcountry and hunting. Not everyone can afford helicopters to lift. A lot of America, you know, works during the week and wants to go out and hunt on the weekend. And if you don't have access, then what it does, it shuts off the legacy of, you know, grandpa going hunting with the kids, or you have military veterans that may be disabled. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is we've tasked, our folks to look at all our range plans, our management plans, and make sure that recreation is a part of it, but also public access. I'm a steward of our public lands. Interior has about a fifth of the territory the United States falls under Interior. And what we want to do is make sure those public lands are protected in perpetuity. But a lot of it is making sure we rebuild our park system, mm-hmm. and public access to make sure that America should use their public lands. Our public lands belong to the people, not the government. Same thing in the government shutdown. The reason why we kept the parks open, the reason why, because our parks and public land belong to the people and not the government, and that's an important part.
I remember under the Obama administration when we had that government shutdown, I live in Central Virginia, and I was driving home from Washington, D.C. I drive through the Wilderness National Battlefield, and there's a little kiosk off on the side of the road. It's never manned. There's nobody ever there, but it's just a little, you know, roadside pull-off. They actually had, you know, sawhorses blocking off the entrance to that little kiosk, so you couldn't even pull in just to read about the battlefield. There was never a staffer there. It wasn't a matter of, you know, well, employees can't be there to make sure that everybody's okay. It really seemed like it was just an egregious middle finger to middle Americans, well, honestly.
And they weaponized our public lands, parks, and battlefields. You know, the World War II monument, you had the guys coming in that served in World War II all of a sudden don't have access to their memorial. In the case of Grand Canyon, you know, they locked the gates. And then there was people that planned their vacation, you know, years in advance. They're knocking on the door, kicking people out of the lodge. So it was egregious. Again, you know, our position is our public lands belong to the public, not the government. Certainly not to special interest groups that want to be elitist about access to our public lands. But, you know, it shouldn't be a Republican or Democrat issue. Public lands is red, white, and blue. This is an American issue. And I subscribe to the American conservation ethic. And I tell this story. You know, Roosevelt is widely, you know, known for being a great conservationist and probably set this country on a path where we enjoy today. Teddy Roosevelt goes out to Yosemite. He meets one of our greatest naturalists, John Muir. And John Muir spent a lot of time trying to put flowers in Roosevelt's pocket. But they go on a ride through Yosemite, a ride, by the way, you could not replicate today because there's too much dead and dying timber. Well, Roosevelt comes back and he hires a gentleman named Gifford Pinchot. And Gifford Pinchot really is the father of American conservation ethic of best science, best practices, greatest good, longest term. And I'm an admirer of Roosevelt, but I fall in the Pinchot camp. Let's actively manage our assets so you don't have these catastrophic forest fires. Mm-hmm. Let's look at systems, wildlife corridors. Let's manage our treasures.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right now on the program this hour. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. John Cardillo joining us on the program as well, talking about the attacks on law enforcement across the nation over the weekend. Right now, though, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day. Hero of the day from Block Club Chicago. .org, man with concealed carry permit returned fire in Avondale shootout, police say. Friday night, near the intersection of Pulaski Road and Belmont Avenue, Dominic Gwynn says, I was sitting in my local corner bar, I heard about 8 shots. Said he was hanging out at the Belford Tavern when he and other patrons heard gunfire. He said by the time he and several others ran outside, it was already over. Shots rang out around 10:48 Friday evening when there were about a dozen people at the bar, Gwynn said. After the shooting, witnesses said one of the vehicles headed north on Pulaski early Saturday morning. Ronald Westbrook's police spokesman said it appeared the shooting had involved 3 men in their early 20s who had been driving in one vehicle when a silver sedan with 3 other men pulled up alongside them. The 3 men in the sedan reportedly began flashing gang signs before one of them drew a gun and began firing. Westbrook says, however, the 21-year-old victim, who is a concealed carry holder, displayed his own weapon and returned fire, and neither party was shot. No injuries have been reported. The gunfire happened across the street from a BP gas station that appears to have at least one surveillance camera facing the intersection. Hopefully, maybe they can get a license plate or something. As of early Saturday morning, no one was in custody, and Area North detectives were still investigating. That tavern patron, Mr. Gwynn, said, I'm kind of surprised this happened here. It's usually a quiet neighborhood. There hasn't been much gang activity. Well, not much, but now apparently a little more. And that concealed carry holder able to protect himself from the would-be drive-by shooting there. Today's hero of the day. On to our deal of the day. From Waterloo, Iowa, the Wayne Post. The suspect in Tuesday's deadly attack in Waterloo, Iowa, has now been charged with second-degree murder. Emerson John Tahavjian was arraigned Friday afternoon in Waterloo Town Court. He's accused of shooting and killing 2 people and injuring another. State police have identified two of the three victims in that shooting Tuesday night. 53-year-old Lori McConnell was killed on Virginia Street there in Waterloo, Iowa, along with a man who has not yet been identified. 50-year-old Karen Zadunko was also shot and treated for her injury. She's since been released from the hospital. Tahavjian's being held without bail, due back in court this Thursday for a preliminary hearing. And the Wayne Post reports that he has a lengthy criminal history that spans nearly 30 years. Yeah. A News 10 NBC investigation revealed that Tahavjian first arrested back in 1990, convicted of robbery. Since then, he's been in and out of jail on a number of violent crimes. On June 3rd of this year, so again, a little more than a month before he allegedly committed this triple shooting, June 3rd of this year, Tahavjian was charged with assault, obstruction of breathing, which sounds like choking somebody, menacing, and criminal mischief for allegedly hitting and choking one of the victims in this homicide. He was arraigned in the town of Fayette Court. Judge Dwayne Riegel set bail at $500. $500. He also issued an order of protection. 2 weeks later, June 19th, Tahavjian accused of violating that order of protection. Court paperwork indicates this time he raped and choked the woman to the point where she thought she would die. He then picked up and threw a cat carrier with a cat inside onto a road, causing an injury to the cat. He again appeared in front of Riegel, who set bail this time at $10,000. Higher than $500. Still, all in all, for violating an order of protection, being accused of rape, $10,000 seems pretty low. By the way, a quick note. I said this was Waterloo, Iowa. This is actually Waterloo, New York, Seneca County. Because the judge said he just followed the recommendations of the Seneca County DA's office in setting bail. At a press conference last Thursday, County District Attorney Barry Porch said in New York State, bail is to ensure that the defendant returns to court. We don't have preventable detention in New York. In other words, what the DA is saying is we don't have a law in New York where we can hold somebody without bond because we think that they're going to be a danger to the community. Likely to reoffend, not likely to show up for the next court hearing. So it doesn't matter if somebody, was accused of assault, choking somebody, they get $500 bail and an order of protection is signed out. And then 2 weeks later, they're accused of violating that order of protection and raping that victim. We can't hold them just because this shows a pattern of escalating violence between the suspect and one particular victim. We can't ask a judge for no bond to hold this over, hold this individual over to trial. Well, the Wayne Post says judicial sources tell News 10 that while $10,000 bail may seem low in some counties, it's not unheard of in smaller rural counties, even on a serious felony charge. The judge, they say, has ultimate discretion. June 21st, a family member posted to Hobson's bail. He was scheduled to appear in the town court on June 27th. The DA says he failed to appear on that day. And my office requested a bench warrant and recommendation of an additional $10,000 bail of $20,000 bond, and the judge refused that request. The judge in that case, Judge Jeff Hu, on Thursday declined to comment on the case, saying he's not legally able to. Channel 10 NBC has learned from three separate sources that it is unconstitutional to double someone's bail without them being present in the courtroom. So that's a nice, neat trick, isn't it? So you bond out, you don't show up for your court hearing, and they can't, they can issue a warrant, but they can't change your bail because you didn't show up, and you have to be present. It's amazing. The town of Varick Court, New York, assured by a Tahavjian's attorney that his failure to appear in court on June 27th was a scheduling misunderstanding and that all parties knew about and agreed to a new July 11th court date. New York State Police Captain Barry Chase says, we all want to put the blame on somebody, and we have. There's a system of laws in our country, but when all is said and done, the person that pulled the trigger is the person that should be held accountable, and he's really the real one to be blamed here. Members of one of the victim's families earlier this week expressed their frustration with how Tahavjian's cases were handled. Ryan Van Doren, who's the victim's son, said, rape is no joke, and I feel like we just treated it as a joke, and we just released him to let him do something worse. We knew what he was capable of, and he was roaming the streets. And here's the thing. I agree completely with New York State Police Captain Barry Chase. The person that pulled the trigger is the person who should be held accountable, and he's really the one to be blamed here. But I also think that we can talk about this system, the current system that we have. We talk about criminal justice reform. I mean, that's a buzzword right now, or at least a buzz phrase, right? But typically, criminal justice reform means we're going to decriminalize some misdemeanors. Maybe we'll move some nonviolent felonies down to misdemeanors. We'll do what we can to get people out of prison. And I'm fine having that conversation. But I also think that there's another angle to criminal justice reform that we don't really talk a lot about, and maybe we should. And they're starting to talk about it in places like Chicago, where right now, you know, you might have, let's say you've got criminal A and criminal B. Criminal A gets arrested for a nonviolent offense. Maybe it's burglary. Put in the Cook County Jail, held on $50,000 bond. That's probably a little high for burglary. Held on $10,000 bond. Then you have a guy who comes in charged with, let's say charged with a drive-by shooting. Bail's higher for him. Bail's, let's say, $50,000. But that individual charged with the drive-by shooting is in a gang, has access to the gang's resources, and can more easily bond out and can be back out onto the streets long before that nonviolent offender, who doesn't have any gang connections, can rustle up the $10,000 so that they can go free. That's actually being talked about now in Chicago. They're talking about, okay, well, what can we do to ensure that, you know, violent criminals don't bond out and then go on to commit more violent crimes while they're out on bond? That, too, is criminal justice reform. I think that it is criminal justice reform, not only talking about what we can do to ensure that there is rehabilitative justice, but also there are real consequences for violent crimes. And this is something that absolutely should be part of the discussion in New York State and around the country. So when you, again, you're innocent until proven guilty. But when you are arrested or charged with a crime, you bond out, you allegedly violate that protective order that's been issued. Now you're accused of a much more serious crime, sexual assault. Can that bond go higher? At what point can the state step in and say, we don't do this with everybody. We don't do this with, you know, the average shoplifter or the average burglar, or we don't necessarily do this with the average individual who we say committed a violent crime. But there's a pattern emerging here. And in order to safeguard the community, in fact, in order to safeguard this particular individual who seems to be a target, that's what we're alleging, that's what we're going to prove in court, that there's a victim here who's a target of this individual over here. We need to ensure that this individual can't have access to that victim. Why can't we talk about that? It doesn't have to be about blaming a judge. It doesn't have to be about just, you know, even, quote unquote, blaming the system. Why don't we talk about how we can fix it? Why don't we talk about how we can address this issue? Anyway, that's today's deal of the day from New York State. Our good guy of the day from the Examiner News in Delaware. Actually, you know, I take that back. I don't think this is Delaware either. This is also New York State, Mount Kisco, New York. Less than 2 weeks ago, Chad Galanik retired from the Newcastle Police Department. But last Wednesday, He's on the Cross Westchester Expressway. And he rushed to the aid of another motorist who apparently had a heart attack. It was July 11th. Chad Galanik saw the vehicle veer from the right lane, go all the way across the lanes of traffic, hit the Jersey barrier on the left side of this parkway, and then come all the way back across the four-lane highway, hitting the right guardrail. The car then came to a rest in the right shoulder. This is just before 12:30 in the afternoon. Galanik said he was traveling westbound on the highway about 4 to 5 car lengths behind when he noticed the out-of-control car. He said he immediately put on his hazard lights. He said, well, all that's going on in my mind because of my experience of being in the police business. He said, I realized that there was no way the person could have been conscious because there was no corrective action taken while that vehicle was out of control. Galanik is just on his way home from a doctor's appointment when he sees what's going on. He ends up pulling up behind the car, gets out, saw that the driver was unconscious behind the wheel, calls 911, begins administering CPR. He said he noticed that the motorist's color wasn't good, that his pulse was there, but it was rapid. Pulled the guy, 49-year-old Alan Marend, out from behind the wheel of the car, placed him on the pavement. When he noticed that Miranda appeared to have a pacemaker implanted. He said, the first set of compressions, I did like 30 compressions. He said, I heard and I saw that he was gasping, and I just continued to do decompressions until the Greensburg Police Department and paramedics came. While he is attending to this motorist, another woman actually stops, pulls over, asks, is there anything I can do? He says, call 911. You can give the first responders updates. Once paramedics arrived, they took over and transported Marin to the Westchester Medical Center. At last report, he was still hospitalized, but he was still alive. Meanwhile, Chad Galanik, who just retired 2 weeks ago, I think June 30th was his last day, he said he was just planning on, you know, spending the summer at home with his son before deciding on what his next career move was going to be. He said, in all his years as a law enforcement officer, he said he had to perform CPR, had to deliver a baby. But he said this was the first time that he was actually just randomly there on scene when somebody had a medical emergency. And he said, quote, I'm glad that I was in the right place at the right time with the right training. And I would hope that anyone in my situation with the training that I had would do the same thing. Well, I hope so too. And I expect that most would. But for being in the right place at the right time and being willing and able to do the right thing, Chad Galanik there in New York State, we thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, stick around. When we come back here on Cam and Company, Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom. Later in the hour as well, John Cardillo joins us. Much more Cam and Company straight ahead, so stick around.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say, I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and desert warfare where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are. Well, everybody knows Bristol's a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium. And they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh. You just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
Let me ask you a simple question. Do you believe you have a right to defend yourself and your family with a firearm in your own home? Four Supreme Court justices say you do. But four say you don't, because the deciding vote announced he's retiring. And your most fundamental right to self-defense could be extinguished. This is our opportunity to protect the one freedom that guarantees all the others. The freedom that makes America different from every other country on earth. The Second Amendment is at stake. America is at stake. We are the last place on earth that still believes in the fundamental God-given right of self-defense. And we don't care if we're the last ones in the arena. We will never, ever stop fighting for this freedom. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children. And freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. John Cardillo going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Center for Individual Freedom, our friend Mr. Tim Lee is with us. Tim, how are you, sir?
Doing well. Got the Gipper looking over me to make sure I don't misspeak here.
I like it. That's nice. In my home office, I have a Fahrenheit 451 poster. And I have a, right behind me, I have a almost as big, I think is that Reagan poster, Whitaker Chambers, baling hay, a rare picture of him actually out on the farm there. So there you go. I like it. And Reagan would have approved of that one too. Now, you've got a piece up at CFIF. Actually, Jeff Mazzella has a piece at CFIF. It's been a while since we've talked with Jeff. But the price and importance of innovation, which I think is really interesting. You know, as somebody, my wife, I've talked about this in the program before, my wife has lung cancer. She is currently getting treatment for this. And they recently changed the standard protocol for lung cancer to include immunotherapy, which is, you know, pretty cutting edge stuff, and this has typically been sort of like the last ditch drug. And they've done some tests, and they've actually shown, wow, no, this really works if you start doing immunotherapy early. And so now, basically, every lung cancer patient is going to get immunotherapy as early as possible. This is expensive stuff, Tim. We got the bill for, you know, just one of these treatments, and we're talking tens of thousands of dollars. And Jeff writes about this. You know, we see that price tag and we think to ourselves, well, gosh, there's got to be another way.
There's got to be a better way, right? Maybe a single-payer system would be a better way. But Jeff writes about the dangers of losing innovation if we were to adopt some sort of a single-payer system like that.
Yeah, there's got to be an incentive to create a lot of these drugs. They wouldn't even exist but for the profit motive and America's intellectual property laws. So when people look at a drug like that and they think to themselves, well, I'm entitled to that at a certain price. Well, it wouldn't exist if you had those sorts of price controls. And that's why we see the innovation that we do in America. Just to give you one statistic, the United States accounts for about two-thirds of all the world's new pharmaceuticals. And why is that? It's because we don't have socialized medicine like much of the world does. I think second place was Japan at about 12%. So whether it's Alzheimer's or cancer drugs or any other life-saving or life-improving pharmaceuticals, they tend to be made in America because we're freed from a lot of those constraints of socialized medicine. If we went to the type of system that they have in other places, you wouldn't see a lot of these innovations because there has to be the profit motive. And so be careful what you ask for type of thing. When you look at a drug and say, hey, this is great and this is saving a lot of lives or this is improving a lot of lives, but I think that it should be half that price, kind of stop and think to yourself, it wouldn't even exist if you could cap the price like that. It's like almost any other innovation known to mankind. Unfortunately, what you see worldwide are practices in those other countries that cap prices, and so it sort of puts some of these pharmaceuticals from America in a bind. That's the danger of it. If you want this type of innovation, if you want these life-saving drugs, if you want these things that make our lives better, if you do happen to be afflicted by one of these diseases, you do not want to go toward what Bernie Sanders would encourage, you know, a socialized medicine system, because it's going to suffocate that type of innovation. America's intellectual property laws also are an incentive for that type of thing. Our patent laws and in music and arts, you know, trademark and copyright as well. But our IP and our profit motive here in America are the precise reason why we account for two-thirds of all the world's pharmaceutical innovations. That's amazing. You know, we're what, 4% of the world's population? We're certainly not two-thirds of the world's wealth. But we account for two-thirds of that type of innovation. So something's working here. And so you don't want to sort of kill the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak.
Well, you know, and part of it, I think, just comes down to how we talk about these things. I mean, you know, I think it's standard practice now on the left to declare healthcare to be a human right. And, you know, look, I talk about self-defense being a human right. And I believe that to be true, but I don't advocate for the government to provide me with a firearm or with ammunition or with government-provided and funded training. I have the right to protect myself, but that's the right. It's not the right to the stuff. And again, I understand having, you know, I've been paying hospital bills here for cancer for 2 years. I'm well aware of the high cost of health care. But as you say, you know, what we're asking for, what are we asking for when we talk about healthcare being a human right? Are we talking about access to healthcare? Or are we talking about the providing of healthcare, which other human beings are going to do, whether it's the nurse or the LPN or the doctor or the researcher? You know, as you say, all of those things come with a price tag, and the profit motive. We don't like to talk about the profit motive much these days because it's seen as sort of you know, a bad word. But that profit motive spurs innovation. It spurs the development. And eventually over time, you know, again, the idea is that the cost of these drugs go down, right?
Right. That's exactly true. And you see it in every area of society. I mean, big screen TVs or pharmaceuticals or any other invention that once it is invented, you do tend to get efficiency improvements and prices do go down over time. But for those who criticize the profit motive and say that that's the wrong way to go about living life or running a government or running a country, I mean, each individual is engaged in the profit motive. You know, for somebody who says that pharmaceutical companies shouldn't have a profit motive, well, they probably go to work every day. And it's based on a profit motive. They exchange their services or their work for profit. So, you know, I asked them if they would like it if their company suddenly went to a zero profit model. They wouldn't like it. And it's the same sort of logic that applies to anything else in society. And in terms of something being a right, how can it be a right if it's dependent upon somebody else giving it to you? Again, sort of flipping the tables here. If somebody says that healthcare is a right, or, you know, insert here is a right, well, they probably are engaged in some sort of business that somebody else could call a right. And so should they be forced to provide it for free? When you talk about the Second Amendment or the First Amendment and those which are true rights, that's not something that depends upon somebody else. That's frankly something that tells somebody else that you can't infringe upon that right. Healthcare is very different in that regard. But, you know, if, for anybody who thinks that, that it is a right to have these pharmaceutical innovations at a certain price, well, nobody's stopping you from living in one of these other countries that, that doesn't have America's healthcare system and doesn't follow the model that we use. And you'll quickly find yourself at a disadvantage in the sense of you're not able to access a lot of these drugs. You know, I'm not sure if this is still true. I suspect it is, but I was once told that Cleveland is actually where more Canadians get their MRIs than any other city in the world, certainly in Canada, and that's because America's healthcare system actually has those sorts of innovations at a more available and more broadly available. So, again, be careful what you ask for, but this sort of highlights how America's innovation is dependent upon the profit motive and a freer market compared to those other countries around the world. And again, I try to emphasize this whenever I speak, intellectual property laws as well. America protects IP, whether it's patent, copyright, or trademark, like no other country in the world, and that's why we see these sorts of innovations. And it's important to protect that.
Talking again with Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. Now, you also have a piece at CFIF, David Arsani at the Federalist, writing this piece, Democrats don't fear Brett Kavanaugh. They fear the Constitution. He highlights some of the reaction to the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, claiming that Kavanaugh would, quote, threaten the lives of millions of Americans for decades to come. But as David Arsani notes, almost none of the objections coming from leading Democrats have even ostensibly been about Kavanaugh's qualifications as a jurist, or for that matter, his interpretation of the Constitution. Instead, Kamala Harris argued, quote, specifically as a replacement for Justice Anthony Kennedy, his nomination presents an existential threat to the health care of hundreds of millions of Americans. So it's not, we're just talking about health care. Here you go. A Supreme Court justice, prospective Supreme Court justice, Tim, is now an existential threat to your personal health here.
To be honest with you, this is another situation where I think you could sort of turn the tables and say not having Judge Kavanaugh become a Supreme Court justice is an existential threat. And here's why. He's protective of the Second Amendment. I wrote about this in my column last week. For those out there who think that Kavanaugh is some sort of moderate squish and an unreliable conservative, look at some of his Second Amendment rulings. And you and I discussed this last week as well. You know, he would throw out the D.C. assault weapons ban, and some of the language that he used was very, very powerful, talking about the right to self-defense and what the Second Amendment means, both in the past and today, and how it's written in the Constitution. And frankly, more guns, as Dr. John Lott has proven time after time, more guns mean less crime. And by protecting the Second Amendment, Judge Kavanaugh would enable more people to protect themselves in areas where they currently can't as well because of Second Amendment restrictions. And so I would turn the tables and say not having Judge Kavanaugh is an existential threat to many people, because he will make for a freer society, certainly a society that respects the Second Amendment more, which allows people to defend themselves, their families, and their homes much better. So let's turn the tables and put it that way.
You know, and it's interesting, Tim, I've had some discussions lately with people just like popping up in my Twitter feed, and not necessarily about Judge Kavanaugh himself, but, you know, it seems like there's this idea, and I'm seeing it on the left. I'm not saying it doesn't exist on the right, but the people I've been interacting with, I think, are on the left. And it's, we don't like the way this country is going. So we need to, you know, pack the Supreme Court when we get back in charge. Somebody was complaining at me the other day, in 20 years, Tim, the population, 70% of the population of the United States is going to be living in just, 15 states. And that means that all these 35 other states are going to have an outsized say in government and the Senate. And we got to do something about that. And my response is, you should amend the Constitution then, because that's what you'd have to do. Well, that's hard. And that's not going to happen because these states would block it. Okay. So what's your point here? Where are you going with this? I've yet to really get a serious response, but this is, I think, now becoming almost a commonplace argument of, okay, over here on the right, we have this existential threat to our way of life, and none of the levers of government that the founding fathers thought of with this incredible system of checks and balances, none of them can stop it. And so the answer is, what exactly?
Yeah, the Constitution has been amended about 30 times, and so to say that we can't amend the Constitution is ridiculous. And in terms of it being anti-democratic in some ways, and every state, even states low in population, having two senators, just like huge states like Texas or California, that's precisely how the founders designed it. And so they wouldn't like it if they were in the minority, and they're going to be glad in future years as that happens. In terms of packing the court, keep this in mind. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1936 enjoyed one of the greatest landslide victories in American political history. Richard Nixon, George Washington, and Ronald Reagan were the only ones who sort of matched that landslide victory. That was just 1936. 1 year later, despite that popularity, Roosevelt, when he tried to pack the courts by raising its numbers, he really faced a huge backlash despite being so popular. So if the left wants to try to pack the court when they're back in power, let them do it. I mean, we saw what happened when the left had total control of the government. Look, Barack Obama's first 2 years, he had a filibuster-proof majority in Congress with 60 Democrats. He had huge majorities in the House. And after just 2 years of rule, you saw people throw them out. And so, the left never learns, perhaps. But once they get back in power, go ahead and try to pack the court. It was unpopular in 1937. It will certainly be unpopular when you try to do it again. So just in terms of historical perspective, maybe they'd be a little bit better off keeping their cool, maybe looking at history and maintaining reason a little bit more. And they'd see what a bad idea that really is.
I would love to see that. Don't think it's likely, but I'd love to see it. Tim Lee, as always, sir, appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Well, we depend on them not being very reasonable, so keep it up, right?
Hey, listen, I'm happy to have a conversation, an argument with a reasonable person. That's fine. We can go that route. I've got no problem with that. All right, when we come back after a quick break here on Cam and Company, John Cardillo is going to join us. And we will talk about the very unreasonable, in fact, downright criminal individuals attacking law enforcement officers, Massachusetts, Kansas City, and then, of course, the story that caused headlines, as well as a near riot in Chicago over the weekend where a armed individual shot and killed by Chicago police. We'll talk about all that and more with John Cardillo right after a quick timeout. Stick around. More Cam and Company's coming up next.
Let's start with the charitable aspect of what you're doing.
Yes.
And I've got to ask, before we get to Special Operations Wounded Warriors, you got a lot less hair on your head.
I do.
Than you had the last time we
talked. I had it down to here. I cut it off for Hawks Locks for Kids. And the children out there that have cancer and lose their hair, they get it for free. So it's a wig they get for free. There's no payment. So A.J. Hawk is a friend of mine, played for the Green Bay Packers. So I, had a clip, and I'll tell you what, it was like freedom. So when we're out in the woods for a week filming the show, by the time I'm done, it's all ratty, and you have to pull stuff out of it. But, no, it's enlightening. So I love the beard. I keep the beard going. I see yours a little bit longer.
Yes, sir.
So there
yes,
you go,
sir.
Grizzly.
Well, we're doing, so this is a part of, what I'm doing here. My wife's cancer came back a few months ago, and I asked her if she wanted me to shave my head.
Right.
And Ron, she said, what's the point? She said, what's the point? There's no point in you shaving your head. You're already bald. So she said, grow out the beard for me.
Okay.
See if you can get it Duck Dynasty style. I'm doing my best. I'm not there yet, but I'm not even to Ron Bell in length yet, but I'm working on it.
You're getting there.
I'm working
on
it.
I see it.
So tell me what's on tap for you in 2018. Let's start with Reaper Outdoors. I mean, this is – how many seasons are you up to now?
This will be our seventh season.
Holy moly.
Yeah. I know. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
So seventh season, we're on the Pursuit Channel. The Pursuit Channel has done a great job of – you know, going HD and bringing the hunting world in and really watching some of the programming that's coming aboard. The other thing for us is, you know, it's a tactical hunting survival show. We try to educate everybody out there in bringing the tactical world into the hunting world that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
and also go out there in the survival mode. Maybe not, you know, rubbing two sticks together to start fires. We can do that. But to be realistic, carry a lighter, carry some matches, start some fire with some flint, get out there in a tent or make your own. Like when we were kids, we'd go out and we would stay in the environment. Kids are great. So you go out and you build a lean-to or a shelter, and a kid can go out there and stay overnight. Why can't we as adults still?
Right.
I think we get so caught up in, you know, automobiles and sleeping in the bed that we kind of forget to go back to Mother Nature. So that's what we try to incorporate into that. And also a good education with the Second Amendment. You know, we're always pushing our Second Amendment rights and why we have the weapons we have. Whether we're hunting with an AR platform mm-hmm. or we're hunting with a muzzleloader, doesn't matter. This is the technology we have today. So we want to pull that into our show and just maintain and really fight for that Second Amendment right to hunt with these weapons as well as, you know, home defense.
Absolutely. So seven seasons in, is it a struggle to find places to go, or do you still have a list a mile long of places you want to go hunt for the show?
No, we absolutely have a long list of places to hunt. The biggest thing is probably just pulling tags mm-hmm. and getting out there. And the other problem, we have the opposite problem. We have a lot of people who want us to come out and hunt, but we have the same people who want us to keep coming back.
Right.
So we have our hunts that we do every year regardless, just because the ranchers are so nice. They become personal friends with myself and my family, and we go up there. And another thing with Special Operations Wounded Warriors, they open up their ranches and their lodges to us to bring guys hunting. So that I might do a hunt in Maine, and then, you know, our boys up in Maine, Matt, White Mountain Lodge up mm-hmm. there, they have us come in and they bring four guys. They donate four hunts.
Wow.
And then we buy the rest of the hunts out, and that's why we raise the money. So we have 10 warriors up there bear hunting. So, you know,
that's fantastic.
That's how it works.
So tell us more about Special Operations Wounded Warriors. What's the mission of this organization?
The mission is to take those who supported that or that are Special Operations fellows or women that have been either wounded in combat or injured in training, to get them into the outdoors, to get them around like-minded people again, you know, because a lot of times we get caught up, and I can say this myself when I retired. I spent about 2 weeks in my house. I had nothing going on. You know, we're kind of in that lull period.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just it's kind of a depression mode, you know. And so we get them out of the house and get them out there. Even if they're active duty, they can still come to these events. And we have them. It's less about the hunt and the kill. It's more about the what we call the campfire stories.
Okay.
So when they get around that campfire, they open up, and then we find out if guys are doing really well and some aren't, and some might have some addictions that we have to, you know, get them into a program.
Mm-hmm.
Might have PTSD issues or health issues or looking for a job. It doesn't matter. Now, that's where we find the problem, and then we continue on with it. We just started a service dog program, and these are high-end dogs. These are $30,000 dogs.
Wow.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you've joined us. John Cardillo from the Rebel and Newsmax going to be with us here in a matter of moments. We'll talk about a violent weekend for police officers across the country. I had mentioned earlier in the program in Weymouth, Massachusetts, police officer Michael Chesna was killed along with a 77-year-old woman who apparently was randomly struck by a gunfire in her home. It is alleged that this 20-year-old who is suspected of killing Officer Michael Chesna killed that woman as well, as he was running from police there on the South Shore.
This started Sunday morning, about 7:30 in the morning. Weymouth Police Department got a call about an erratic driver. Responding officers came across a single car accident involving a BMW. The driver had been seen leaving the scene on foot. The assistant district attorney, Gregory Connor, said the Weymouth Police Department responded, began looking for this person in the local area. One of the officers that was looking was Officer Michael Chesna. He responded in his police cruiser and saw the suspect, quote, actively vandalizing a home, throwing rocks at a home on the street. Officer Chesna got out of his car, drew his firearm, commanded the man to stop. Instead, that suspect allegedly threw a rock at Officer Chesna, striking him in the head with a large stone. Officer Chesna fell to the ground. The assistant district attorney says the suspect then retrieved Officer Chesna's firearm and discharged it several times into his head and chest. And when officers responded, this guy took off running and again allegedly fired at officers. Emmanuel Manny Lopez, 20 years of age, is the suspect in the death of Officer Chesna, as well as the death of a 77-year-old woman who, again, was at home and was shot and killed there in her house. Authorities say they are withholding the name of the victim. Families and friends have identified her. I won't release her name, but she was described as a widow who had no children. Her sister-in-law told the Boston Globe that the lifelong Weymouth resident was a wonderful person and an avid reader. A candlelight vigil for both of these individuals, Officer Chesna and the woman who was killed there in Weymouth, Massachusetts, planned for 7 p.m. tonight at Weymouth High School. And the suspect in this case, again, known to law enforcement. Not the lengthy criminal history that we've seen. For example, the accused killer of Officer Sean Gannon in Yarmouth, Mass., not far from Weymouth. He had 114 different contacts. This suspect, again, not nearly as lengthy a criminal history, but was currently on pretrial probation in connection with an arrest back in October, charged with selling cocaine to minors as well as resisting arrest. He ran from officers, later arrested with the help of a police canine. In September of 2017, Lopez had been arrested for vandalizing a dry cleaner's. Both of those arrests there in Weymouth, Massachusetts, had been ordered to submit to random drug testing. And again, was on pretrial probation, but was once again out on the streets. And you are starting again in Massachusetts to hear more people speak up about this. We told you last week about the mayor in, I think it was Springfield, Massachusetts, who also was speaking out publicly about another violent criminal who was recently taken into custody after committing another violent crime, should have been behind bars and still was out on the streets. Then in Kansas City over the weekend, we had three police officers who were shot. Man wanted for questioning the murder of a college student. Shot three police officers in Kansas City, Missouri on Sunday during a series of firefights that began at a motel, ended with his death when he bolted from a home trying to shoot at officers. Started just after noon at a motel there in Kansas City where undercover and tactical officers were conducting an investigation into the robbery and the killing at a restaurant last week of a 25-year-old University of Missouri, Kansas City student. Kansas City Police Chief Rick Smith said detectives have been conducting surveillance on a person of interest in that homicide back on July the 6th that followed him to a local motel on the east side of the city. Smith told reporters or officers then engaged with that person and they were trying to surveil, and there was gunfire. At that point, two of our officers were shot. The suspected gunman fled the scene in a vehicle along with a second individual. Officers chased that individual to a residential neighborhood. Arrested one of the men who had sped from the motel. The armed suspect ran from the vehicle, barricaded himself in a home, fired on officers as they approached the residence. A third detective was wounded in that firefight. Thankfully, in this case, all three officers treated for non-life-threatening injuries. The suspect in this case pronounced dead on the scene there in Kansas City. And then in Chicago, we saw the shooting of an individual armed, a FOID card holder, but apparently illegally carrying that firearm, stopped by police, questioned, then turning and running. The body cam video that the Chicago Police Department released shows the individual with a firearm in their waistband and then attempting to reach for that firearm as they were shot by officers. That led to, I don't want to overestimate it by calling it a riot, but Cameron, it was kind of a riot there in Chicago. I mean, you had arrests, you had certainly unrest on these streets.
I would call it a small riot. It wasn't, you know, citywide, but it was concentrated groups of people who were really angry, tipped off by false media reports, and just angry. And so it was a small riot, and it was very dangerous for a while. I saw a lot of pushing back and forth. I saw people get hurt, some officers get pushed. I mean, it's an ugly scene, and in any American city in 2018, you don't want to see that. But we have seen more and more of it. It seemed to have gone away for a while, but it feels like it's ticking back up again, and I don't know why. But it feels like it seems to be getting worse again.
Yeah, and I don't know. You know, I mean, again, it could be it's the summer, and in the summer, not only does violent crime tend to tick up, but you're outside more. You could probably, back in the 60s, when we had riots on an almost yearly basis, they would actually talk about riot season, and they would issue forecasts for riot season. Like, well, we think Detroit this year it's going to be partly rioty with a chance of peace in mid-August or so. There, you know, you get a little break there. So it could be just a function of this is what happens in the summer. We're more likely to see these types of incidents. Could be that, once again, this is being reported more in the media. But, you know, and I'm looking here at WAND TV, their headline, Chicago officer involved shooting incites riot. So we'll call it a riot. You know, again, this shooting occurred Saturday afternoon. By Saturday night, there are, again, people in the streets clashing with police officers. And we live in this day and age of instantaneous access to information. That does not mean that we have instantaneous access to all of the pertinent facts on hand. Right? It just doesn't. We have to wait for the pertinent facts. And the Chicago police did release that body cam video the next day, released that video Sunday. And to be fair, it sounds like while there were still demonstrations or a vigil Sunday night, I don't think there were any arrests that were made. I don't think that it was that violent confrontation. But again, unfortunately, you know, we can talk about the media. We can talk and not just the news media, but the social media that we are all a part of. And the ability, again, to gain access to incomplete information as it happens. But our willingness to put aside the fact that we don't know all the information and to go ahead and react on what little we do know. I mean, I think ultimately, again, it comes back down to us and how we react. And what's the punishment for not waiting for the facts? I mean, you could get arrested, I suppose, if you went out there into the streets and you clashed with police officers. That would be a consequence of that. But generally speaking, there are very little consequences, very, very few consequences for not waiting until the facts are known. Whether you are going to head out in the streets to protest what you believe to be an injustice, or you're a member of the media reporting on information that you really haven't confirmed. Maybe you've got it from one source who doesn't want to go on the record, but boy, it's really juicy and you're pretty sure it's right. So you're going to go ahead and report it anyway. And, you know, if it's wrong, what's the worst thing that happens? You issue an addendum to that original tweet that got, you know, 10,000 retweets and your addendum gets 14 retweets. But that's, you know, okay, so what? You're not going to get reprimanded. You're not going to get dismissed. There's not going to be any real consequence there. Again, I think ultimately it's on us to do better, to wait for all of the facts to be known. But if that, I mean, again, that's just sort of, you know, the reward for doing that is then you don't look like somebody who just immediately launches and leaps to conclusions, including erroneous ones. And I'm not sure that that's actually a big enough incentive for a lot of folks these days. So I'm kind of with you, Cameron. It's kind of gone away. I think it's coming back, and I sort of suspect that it's going to continue, if not get a little worse here in the weeks and months to come. All right, we will try to reconnect with John Cardillo at some point in the near future. Apologies for not being able to hook up with him on this segment of the program. One more story before we let you go. The latest out of New York 21, as reported by North Country Public Radio, this was today, and the press in upstate New York seems to have largely moved on from Ted Dracov, the Democratic candidate, being caught on tape telling gun control activists, you know, I was talking to this woman today, and she said, do you support an assault ban? And I said, I do, but I can't talk about it publicly. And she said, I wish you would. And I said, I can't. I'll lose the election. Yeah, they kind of moved on. This is North Country Public Radio. New York 21 race gets fierce early with attack ads and secret recordings. And they had this interview with Brian Mann, who is the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio, and the host, Martha Foley, says, let's begin with some questions about substance, about policy. Already seen some pretty stark contrasts in the race. And Brian Mann, the analyst, says, that's right. Campaigns are noisy, clumsy ways to tell a story. But if you pay attention, you can see there's some real grit to the message. In this race so far, we have Ted Dracov, the Democratic challenger, making it clear that she supports some forms of gun control, though she's not committing to supporting an assault weapons ban. She's also continued to push for a really active, prominent role for the government in making sure that all Americans are covered by some form of health insurance. So she's making it clear that she supports some forms of gun control, though she's not committing to supporting an assault weapons ban. That's one way of putting it. It's a really bad way of putting it. It's a really misleading way of putting it. But it's, I suppose, one way of putting it. He said, and then Martha Foley, the reporter, asked, well, okay, what about Stefanik, the Republican incumbent? Quote, she's used these opening weeks of the campaign to make it clear that she's a fully committed Second Amendment NRA supporter. She's voted to actually loosen gun control laws, supporting a bill that would make it easier for people to carry concealed weapons in New York. She also continues to support measures that would dismantle government health care programs known as Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. So these are real differences that really affect people's lives. So, you know, again, completely neutral report in there from North Country Public Radio. No thumb on the scales there. All right, that music means we've got to go. Thank you so much for tuning in to this edition of Cam and Company. Let's do it again tomorrow. What say you? 2 p.m. Eastern work for everybody. We'll see you there. And then right here on NRA TV.